Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
Hi, this is Brian Elias, president of 1-800-HANSONS. Need new windows, siding, roofing, doors, or gutter protection, but not quite ready to buy? Well, click on the banner above and enter my exciting home makeover sweepstakes. You could win the home improvement of your dreams. Come on, get it done.
313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. And Night Call, this hour brought to you by Waking Up. It's Metro Detroit Sweatshop Free Clothing Store. It's located in the Universal Mall at 12 Mile Road of the Quinder in Warren. You can go to wakingupstore.com. Now, Mike Kitchen has sent the proprietor, along with his wife Denise. He says, we are continuing our Get a Jump on the Holidays sale for the week of November 6th to the 12th. That's coming up. Everything in the store is 15% off, 20% for union members. Another good reason to join a union. Excuse me. There we go. How's that sound? Sounds about the same, doesn't it? Anyway, I mean, can you believe what's going on? This is, am I the only one that looks at, no, I know I'm not. Everyone I talk to says things are just totally out of control with this election coming up. Well, one of the most interesting things, though, you know, if you only get 40% of the votes, your opponent gets 60, you get 40, it's called the landslide. Well, they expect that only about 40% of the people are going to vote. So these hundreds of millions of dollars, that's what's been spent all across the country. Because this is a game of not of politics, but of money driving politics, obviously. And all of these ads that you see on television, all these phone calls that you get, it's just aimed at those 40%, which makes sense. I remember a few years ago, maybe it was the city of Detroit, something, or Wayne County, or something like that. 17% of the people took part in the primary. But in a sense, it doesn't matter. But another way to look at it, when you think, somebody or other has a mandate, they're getting about maybe 25% of the adult population are saying, okay, or lower, or less. I mean, can you believe these Republicans and these Christian ministers falling out one after another? It's astounding. They couldn't all be hypocrites, could they? All of these rabid anti-gay politicians and ministers, they couldn't all be gay, could they? You know, they're always saying the Democrats have a homosexual agenda. We've talked about that before. Remember, they don't say, if I can make this difference, they don't say homosexual. They say homosexual, right? And they don't even go in stores that say homo milk. You know those signs? Why do they say that? All milk is homogenized, isn't it? But here you have Reverend Ted Haggard scoring crystal meth, having sex with a male prostitute, and heading the largest evangelical association, the evangelical association in the United States. In this New Life Church, is got like 14,000 members, and he said he admitted that he was guilty of sexual immorality. So what is going through these guys' head? I mean, a lot of people live double lives, and it is kind of tough. But the level of hypocrisy is absolutely astounding, isn't it? That it turns out that the people within the gay old party now, the GOP, the grand old party, the greedy oil people, whatever, that for one thing, a lot of the top Republicans have gay staff members, and everybody knows it. And Bush, who outwardly, politically, opposes gay marriage, he'll go to events and introduce the life partner of a gay couple. He doesn't have any problem with that. I mean, so it's essentially, in fact, but it's true across the board. It's all just, I don't know, soap for the rubes. And it's still astounding to me how many of you actually swallow it. That when you hear them express this indignation or about this or that or anything, that you really believe that they're sincere spokespeople. That they actually care deeply about these issues as opposed to manipulating your deeply held beliefs in order to get you to put them in office so they can loot you and the rest of the middle class and the working class. I mean, that's what it's all about. mean, they're not interested in good government. They're not interested in abortion. They're not interested in suppressing gay marriage. They're not interested in what they're interested in is making an enormous amount of money for their core constituency, which is the top 1%. But in an ostensible democracy, I say ostensible, I mean the appearance of democracy, because we get to vote, even if 60% of us aren't going to do it, that really all the big decisions are made by Mr. Big. They don't even have Mrs. Big. It's all Mr. Big. It's Bushies and that type. It's Cheney types. Most of them are in corporations, think tanks, stuff like that. Mostly corporations. Let's see, what do we have here? So, and this is Reverend Ted Haggard. He says, the fact is I'm guilty of sexual immorality, and I take responsibility for the entire problem. Hello. I am a deceiver and a liar. There's a side of my life that is so repulsive and dark that I've been warring against it all of my adult life. Then there's a sex life as well. Oh, I guess that's what he's talking about. But, I mean, can't we say thank you to Mike Jones? It's so whistleblowers, because the whole institutional nature of this system is set up to protect the wealthy and the privileged and the powerful. So it'll take a Mike Jones. Mike Jones is the male prostitute who was doing crystal meth with Reverend Ted Haggard. I mean, isn't that a joke, the Reverend Ted Haggard? Leading the campaign in Colorado against gay marriage, and he's doing all this crystal meth. You know, this is to increase the sexual, the sex. I guess we'll leave it at that. Probably some kids listening. But just hypocrisy beyond belief. Now, there's a couple of interesting side notes about Reverend Ted Haggard that some of you may know. One is that he was in the documentary Jesus Camp. Jesus Camp is a documentary about these Pentecostal, talking in tongues, far-right-wing evangelicals that bring these kids to a camp in North Dakota and send them into paroxysms of religious frenzy and hysteria. I mean, it's really frightening to me that thinks that reasonable discourse is a way in which we can figure out each other and get an idea of what the world's about. I mean, it's hard enough figuring out each other in relationships, friends and, you know, lovers and husbands and wives and stuff like that. But perhaps some of the material world is knowable. The scientific method says it's all knowable. I'm not 100% sure that's the case. But we've made an effort. It's more true than the ones that were that explained things prior to the scientific age, to be sure. So anyway, here's Jesus Camp, and they go to this mega church in Denver, and who's there? Reverend Ted Haggard, who comes off like a real a-hole. He's just arrogant. He's flippant. He is dismissive of the camera crew. Now, the people that were the center of Jesus Camp, Reverend Becky, I can't even think of her last name. They just kind of call her Reverend Becky, who I found. You know, I asked the director. Some of you may have heard the interview I did with the director, Heidi Ewing, who's from the Detroit area. And she said she really grew to like these people. And I said, I didn't like any of them. I didn't like any of them at all. I thought, you know, manipulating children in this manner was really despicable. But she doesn't come off like an awful person. Reverend Ted does. I mean, he might have been, you know, whacked out on crank at the time. Who knows? He might have just come from, you know, doing a little sex session with Mike Jones and was still a little cranked. So that's why he was the way he was. In any event, he doesn't like the film at all. And who can blame him? He doesn't come off looking very well. On the other hand, a lot of the evangelicals, including Reverend Becky, think that it's that the film's kind of cool because there's no narrative. Every once in a while, Mike Papantonio, who is a Christian and a liberal broadcaster on the Air America Radio Network, would come in with kind of a counterpoint and say, this isn't what Christianity should really be about. But he has a very small role, and I could understand how the evangelicals could like it. It kind of depends on where you're coming from. If you're an evangelical and you like the Pledge of Allegiance and you kind of start off rather than the way it is, you know, people are talking about, should we take God out of, you know, under God, that was put in the 50s to distinguish us from the godless communists. You know, someone might have thought, if we didn't add that after all these years, someone might have thought we were communists. So the Congress in its deliberative majesty inserted that. And some people say it doesn't belong in. Because, you know, the Pledge of Allegiance was put together by a Christian socialist, a guy named Bellamy. And so he was a socialist, but he was also a Christian. So he knew the words under God, but you know, he didn't want that in there. But these whacked out anti-communists in the 1950s thought that it belonged in there. Where the hell am I? Reverend Haggard. The other thing that's interesting about Reverend Ted Haggard, other than he's one of the more colossal frauds, or who's a more colossal fraud, him or Mark Foley, the Republican from Florida, who's writing legislation against, including stuff from the Internet, that would stop predators from preying on children, and here, this is what he's doing. I mean, don't you suspect... Well, wait a minute. Let me finish my point about Ted Haggard. I'll get back to that. Haggard is head of what they call a mega church. These things where they have coffee shops in there and gift shops, and it's, you know, it's kind of like a little community. That was kind of true back in our grandparents' days as well. Maybe some of you have that as well in your current church. But they really dominated the neighborhood, and Reverend Ted's church does that in Denver as well. Hey, by the way, I'm real proud. I'm sorry, I can't stick on a subject. That it was my old pal Jay Marvin who really brought this out in the open. He's a talk show host in Denver, and he got the investigative reporter that talked to Mike Jones, the gay guy that was supplying Reverend Ted with the crank, and got him on the air, and that just exploded it. So my hat's off to you, Jay. I mean, isn't it nice to expose hypocrites? All right, so you got the mega churches, and one of, they have an interesting facet to them. A lot of them, I mean, are generally conservative and evangelical. But some of them have been taking a contrary stand in terms of what most of the right wing wants to do. Most of the right wing wants to just chew up our environment so they can make more profit. They want to be able to pollute the air and the water and everything like that and not have to put on any safety or pollution control equipment, because to do so would cut into their profit. And they'd rather poison us, poison themselves. That's why they're such utter lunatics, and poison the planet than spend a few more bucks in order... to make the earth a little more easier to live on. But Ted Haggard believes global warming. Now, all of these nutball right-wingers, they don't believe it. They just, like the head multimillionaire talk show host who's always making up stuff, he says that that the whole reason that the liberals have made up this stuff about global warming is because they want to take away your SUV. It's not that every climatologist in the world, with the exceptions of the one that are being paid by ExxonMobil, think that global warming is real, and we're beginning to see more and more evidence of it. But it's one of the articles of faith that global warming is just liberal BS. But Reverend Ted Haggard, maybe it was the crank that did it to him as well. He figured it out. There really is global warming, and he thought that Christians should take a stand in supporting conservation and other things having to do with making the world a better environmental place. So our hats off to him for that. Nothing, I don't think, alters the fact of what a credible hypocrite he is. And the fact that he was leading. I mean, why would he want a gay marriage? He doesn't want a gay marriage. He's married to a woman. He has five kids. So he doesn't want a gay marriage. He just wants to, you know, snort up a lot of crystal meth and go have gay sex. But that's real hypocrisy. The other thing is, he said that Christians should be in the forefront against poverty and against racism. So it's a little interesting side about this guy. And they're all like this. They're not all like that. A lot of them are. Republican congressman in Pennsylvania accused of abusing his ex-mistress agreed to pay her about $500,000 in a settlement last year that contained a powerful incentive to keep her quiet until after Election Day. So she was told she's going to get $250,000 right away, but she's not going to get the rest if she lets this out before the Election Day. So this is Don Sherwood. This is the congressman in Pennsylvania that Bush went to pump for. This is the kind of people that Bush supports. He takes the, what can you say? The, I don't want to say majesty, because that's what he'd like to see. The prestige of the most powerful political leader in the world, and dumps it on a Republican who has to pay $500,000 to his, what was he, Peruvian or Bolivian, because he was choking her and they had to call the police. But so why would poor Ted Haggard live this life? How did he, of sexual immorality, a side of his life that is so repulsive and dark that he's been warring against it all of his adult life? That's right. It's the woman's fault. It's Ted's wife's fault. Who else could you blame it on? Ted says he took responsibility for it all. We have to hand him to that. Hand that to him. But actually, where is that? Oh, yeah. Here, from the Huffington Post. Who's to blame for Pastor Haggard's fall from grace? His fat, lazy wife. That's what Reverend, let's see, where's his name? Mark Driscoll. He's got a big church out in California. And, you know, this is all cut off here. Damn. But he says that it's not uncommon to meet pastors that are trapped into fidelity. Now, this is a Christian preacher talking about trapped in fidelity. And essentially he's saying that the wives let themselves go, right? They let themselves go and they don't give it up. Now, I'll tell you. These standards of beauty, which dominate in this society, which are really tough on women, very tough on women to begin with. And it's even tougher as you start to age. It's tough when you're 25 or 30 to look really hot in terms of all the ads that you see on television and those horrible magazines like Cosmopolitan. I was coming on a plane last week back from New York, and I was reading over the shoulder of this young woman who was reading Cosmo or something like that about 10 things he wants you to do to him. And I mean, how do they, every month they have 10 other things, but that was okay. That was dumb enough. I read one and it had to do with teeth. So I don't even want to go there and I don't want to meet this woman. I am trapped in fidelity. So that's all right. But the thing that I thought was really insidious were the ads in for clothing and for makeup. Because for one thing, it's almost kiddie porn. Most of these models are teenagers, and also they're like the 1% of the 1% of the most beautiful teenagers around. So women then have to. So that's the model. It's a model for women, and the image model. It's the image model for women, and it's the image model for men. So they look at their girlfriend. We're talking heterosexual here. We'll leave Ted Haggard for a while, doing some crystal meth and, banging some gay guy. So heterosexual women are stuck trying to conform to this unrealizable image, and so many of us guys are demanding that of them. Okay, we're 25 years old. I'm a little older than that. But, you know, you're 25 years old, and your girlfriend is 21, 22, 23, and she can very possibly come near that. Not all, but some. And if you use a lot of makeup and a lot of clothes and, you know, you do everything you can so you're a Cosmo image model, you can maybe get somewhere near there. Then you get to be 35 and 45 and 55. Now, Reverend Ted is 50 years old. Let's say his wife is somewhere around there, 48, something like that. Well, it becomes obviously just by biology that a woman finds it harder and harder to achieve those standards, those image models, as they age. They can't. They can't do it. And then there's another little factor, too. What is that? What were we learning about Reverend? Oh, yeah. He had five kids. And I don't have any children. My wife never had any children. But it seems to me the women I know that have had a couple kids, particularly right when it happens, kind of takes them out of shape, out of the Cosmo image model, doesn't it? And when you get to be 50 and you have five kids, well, then, you know, you're, and maybe you say, you know, not giving up the booty or something. Can I say that? I don't know. Not giving it up. That's the other complaint. I mean, that I'm saying, can I say that? This is what these Christian ministers are doing. These Christian ministers are having gay sex while whacked out on crank. And a guy defending him, saying it's his wife's fault because she's letting herself go and not giving it up. And I'm wondering, can I say that? I am. You know, I was actually going to be a little low-key, but I guess I'm not. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Call talkyes at yahoo.com. Is that all for that? Oh, yeah. You know, Bush has sent patriotism down the drain because it's this fraudulent patriotism that he and the rest of those gangsters that make up this racket ruling us exhibit. So people, they feel if you fly the flag, someone's going to think you're a right-wing Republican. If you have a little flag pin, they're going to think you're a Bush supporter. In fact, if I see somebody with a flag pin, I think that's a Bush supporter. And you don't even see those guys very much anymore. Remember, a lot of that came around 2001, around 9/11. But that's gone away. The other thing that Bush Co., the whole racket, has managed to do with all this phony Christianity that they put forth, and we know it's phony because I don't have that in front of me, but this book just came out with written by the man who was head of the division of the racket that is violating the Constitution. The first thing in the Bill of Rights, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion and giving away money to religious groups, doing that in order to buy their votes. They take our money collectively and they buy votes for their party. Right? This is one aspect of it being a racket. I mean, the whole thing is a racket. Well, what they've done is that in 2000, 80% of the Americans polled said they were certain God existed. So that left 20% of us, agnostics and atheists and, I don't know, maybe pagans or something like that. But now Bush has managed to drive it down. Nearly half, this is from the Argus Leader from Sioux City, Iowa. You know, I just always read these papers. Nearly half of Americans are not sure God exists, according to a poll that also found divisions among the public on whether God is male or female, or whether God is a human form, and whether he controls, whether, I actually lost, why are my printers cutting everything off on the half here? The survey conducted by Harris Poll found that 42% of U.S. adults are not absolutely certain there is a God, compared to 34% who felt that way when they were asked some 3 years ago, I guess it is. Among the various religious groups, yada, 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 only 1% think of God as a female. Have you ever heard that thing where they say God is coming back and she's pissed? So maybe that's just for the 1%. As to whether God controls events on Earth, 29% believe that to be the case. So little under a third of us believe that God controls events. Well, I mean, what are they... I mean, hurricanes, holocausts, inquisitions, World War I and II, he's controlling this? If I believe that, I'd find another one, I'll tell you. 29% believe that to be, 29% believe that to be the case. 44% said God observes but does not control what happens on Earth. And 42% of us aren't even sure this is meaning anything. Now, that's kind of weird, too. God has absolute powers, if we're to believe the talk of him. He's not a demigod. He's not less than an all-powerful God. So he could create the universe and create all of its creatures, including all of us. And he's omniscient. He sees all, right? So he knew Adam and Eve were going to fall. And he knew that these insane right-wingers in Germany were going to kill 6 million Jews and millions of communists and gypsies and Slavs and people like that. So why did he do it? Well, he wanted to give them free will. But it's not free will if it's all known to him in advance. So I never got this story very much. You're welcome to try it. I don't know. I don't know if I wanted to have it explained. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Yeah. One other thing. Saddam Hussein, the butcher of Iraq, pals with Ronald Reagan, Donald Rumsfeld, Bush 1, till Bush 1 figured he could serve more of a role for him in the U.S. if he attacked him. So, we just learned today that Saddam not only has been found guilty of one of the mass murders, actually the United States was not complicit in this one. In this whole huge war in the 1980s that Iraq and Iran fought, the United States, through its policies and its corporations, played a great role. And in fact, the United States was giving intelligence to Saddam Hussein. So the fact that he kind of went off and killed 180 of his enemies or something like that either shouldn't surprise us, or they should have Donald Rumsfeld and Bush 1 in the docket with Saddam, I'd say. So there's a great division among Sunnis and Shia in Iraq right now. What's appropriate? The Shiites who suffered under Saddam Hussein disproportionately are very happy. The Sunnis are very pissed off. But the Pope's against it. The Pope's against capital punishment. Where did I see something else? The European Union. So any way you cut this, isn't going to work well. But where's my letter here? You know, I don't know why I'm so annoyed. It must be the full moon. It's the only thing that I can cop to here. But Mike in Toledo wrote in. I remember the letter. It was very short. And he said, isn't it a coincidence they announce that there is a verdict on Saddam 2 days before the election? What a coincidence. Here's what Scott Horton said. Scott Horton is the chairman of the International Law Committee of the New York City Bar Association, professor at the University of Columbia Law School. He says, most observers expected the date would be much later, but it seems to have been moved up. It will be front page news in the papers on Monday, the day before the election. This is designed to show some progress in Iraq. The public will see Saddam condemned to death and see it as a positive thing. Now, another professor, Richard Falk, who's an emeritus professor of international law at Princeton, he said it should come as no surprise that the final verdict in the Saddam Hussein criminal trial seemed timed to coincide with the November U.S. midterm elections. The U.S. government should be ashamed to have debased international justice by orchestrating every phase of this trial in Baghdad from start to finish to divert domestic public opinion in this country from the dismal failure of the Iraq policy. He says, Professor Falk does, it is a sad day for American democracy if the citizens of this country fall for such a cheap propaganda trick amid a dreadful war that is wasting the lives of its young soldiers and bringing massive suffering to the Iraqi people. And as you know, Cheney says, doesn't matter what happens to the election, we are going onward with our policy in Iraq. And where's Cheney going to be on election day? He's heading to South Dakota on a hunting trip. You got to look out for that. Who's he going to shoot this time? All right, we can take some calls before the break. Let's see. Let's go to Jennifer. Jennifer is in New Hudson. Hey, Jennifer, it's Peter Werby. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Okay. I have a wonderful story for you.
A wonderful what?
Story.
No, story. Go ahead.
Okay. I have this T-shirt with George Bush's picture on it, and next to the picture, it says, "Not my president." I'm out the other day grabbing some coffee, and I'm just minding my own business, walking across the parking lot. This older lady comes up to me, and she goes, "You should be ashamed of yourself." I'm like, "What?" She's like, "How could you wear a T-shirt like that?" I'm like, what do you mean? She's like, "It's people like you who are ruining the nation and this and that." And I'm like, "You don't even know me. So what you're saying is because he's my president, I should like him, and I should like his beliefs?" And she's like, "Well, you should show some support for your country." I said, "You don't have to like your president to show support for your country." And she just continued to cuss me out.
These are fascist mentalities that we come up with, is that the ultimate leader is identified with the nation state, and their whole psychology is interwoven with it. And people that don't show it, the obeisance, the loyalty, the fawning of whatever, are condemned to the darkest room in fascist hell. So you know, and me, Jennifer, have really stepped over this line. Because you got to remember, these people are rigid authoritarians, and everything has to be in this hierarchy. And of course, I mean, they're total frauds because all you see is, you know, they're corrupt. They're the sexual scandals, a hundred other things that they're doing. I mean, who's ruining the country is George Bush.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's my belief. And I have people ask me all the time. They say, are you going to vote, you know, and this and that and the other, because you're a young person, because I'm only 20. And they're like, so what you're voting for is your future. And I said, no. And just like you were saying, only 40% of people are going to vote. And that's because there is no right choice. There really isn't. You got people like, who do we got right now for Michigan that were like Michael Bouchard?
Yeah.
Please. He's basically got his head up Bush's rear end.
Well, so what are you saying? You're not voting?
I would not say that I'm not voting, but I can't really decide on who I would actually vote on. I really don't believe in any of their political campaigns.
Well, neither do I. Here's how I vote. The Republicans have to be punished.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only one way to do it, unfortunately. And one of the things that the Republicans depend on is low voter turnout, because their legions are extraordinarily loyal. And every exposure that we've seen, and this is hardcore Republicans, every exposure that we've seen, every fraud, every lie, every corruption, every sex scandal, that means nothing to these people. I always use the example, Jennifer, that if we showed movies, if there were videos of Bush and Cheney strangling little kids, and they said, oh, we were giving them the Heimlich maneuver, they'd go, oh, yeah, they were giving them the Heimlich maneuver. So the loyal base, the people that will do anything to the sheeple, the people that follow the leader, no matter how bad the leader is, they're going to be out there on Tuesday, believe it. All right, I got to move on. Thank you, Jennifer. And that actually brings up a question, too, about why people don't vote. And again, I think that people from the center over to the left tend to be more discerning people and have an intellect that is offended by hypocrisy and fraud and opportunism. And we see that considerably in the Democratic Party. You talk to these Republicans, they say, no, George Bush is the most honest man in the world. And you say, what about Kerry? What about Clinton? What about, and we go, well, you know, and I mean, how many Democrats, among the Democrats that are listening, how many Democrats are there of the upper echelon leadership that you say, oh, they're just the most wonderful person ever? Most wonderful person ever. You don't get too many of that. We have real criticisms of all these Democratic Party candidates. And a lot of times, like I voted for Kerry. I held my nose. I mean, he ran such an awful campaign. If he would have talked before, again, he weaseled out and apologized for something he didn't have to apologize for, because he wasn't insulting the troops. He was insulting George Bush, and every damn Republican knew that. And the right-wing media piled on. Then these opportunistic Democrats like Hillary Clinton got in the act and you have to apologize. And he probably should have said, you know, F-O, right? Because he did at first. He did. Let me see. Do I have that up here at first? What he said at first? See if I can read this. Here's what Kerry initially said. I'm sick and tired of a bunch of despicable Republicans who will not debate real policy, who won't take responsibility for their own mistakes, standing up and trying to make other people the butt of these mistakes. He says, it disgusts me that a bunch of these Republican hacks who never worn the uniform of our country are willing to lie about those who did. He says, this is Kerry, I'm not going to be lectured by a stuffed suit White House mouthpiece standing behind a podium talking about Tony Snow, or doughy Rush Limbaugh, who no doubt will take a break from belittling Michael J. Fox's Parkinson's disease to start lying about me just as they have lied about Iraq. Now, damn, John Kerry, why didn't you talk like that during the election? You would have been in the White House, and maybe I would have only held one nostril or something, you know, when I cast my ballot for him. I mean, Rush Limbaugh, with the rest of these people, are chicken hawks. You know what a chicken hawk is? One of these guys that are really big on the war and they want other people to fight it. Most of them had the opportunity to fight in Vietnam, but didn't. If, in fact, if you go to my website, Peter Werbe, PeterWerbe.com, and scroll down a little, and you'll see Chicken Hawk. Just click on that, and you'll go to this amazing list of Chicken Hawks. Now, Rush Limbaugh, he had anal warts, wasn't that it, or something like that, something on his butt. So those of you who think that Rush Limbaugh is a perfect a-hole, it turns out he's not, and that's how he managed to scam his way out of the draft during the time when he could have served. Dick Cheney, he said he had other priorities, right? He didn't want to get shot. He didn't want to have to waste villages and things like that. He wanted to be vice president and a multimillionaire. All right, we'll take a break. Right back to get your calls. I'm Peter Werbe. 313-298-WRIF.
This is WRIF.
It's been a while since I could
WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werbe.
All right, thank you very much. Let's rip. 313-298-WRIF. 313-298-9743. I was thinking about taking one of those unscreened calls, just asking if you're going to vote and who for. And so it would be yes, or you could say Republican, Democrat, or you could say no. Or I mean, there's other parties as well. All right, let's go to Sarah. Sarah's over in Windsor. Sarah, hi, it's Peter Werbe. Thanks for making our show international. Hi, you're on the air.
I don't know if it's international. I mean, I'm like 20 minutes away.
Well, still, we're in a different country. I had to show my passport. I was just over there on Saturday. I actually took a labor history tour on a big bus that was put together by the University of Windsor. It was very, very interesting. You know, over on Drouillard, they have all those murals up on the wall.
Yeah, aren't they beautiful?
They're very cool.
I love my city.
You know what? You know, if Bush ever turns this country fascist, that's what a lot of us are afraid of.
Yeah, just come right up here. We got free health care. It's a pretty sweet deal.
It is. What's up with you?
I'm a 16-year-old girl. Sorry, I'm pretty nervous.
It's okay.
Living in Windsor, and I just have a lot of problems with society in general and how you guys have a double-sided mirror with Canada, and it's almost frustrating because the political, like, politics in the United States really do affect Canada.
Sure.
And the pollution and everything, it's just horrible. And it comes right back to us, and there's nothing I can do about it. I can't go over there and vote, and I can't change that, 60% of people who aren't voting?
Well, I mean, for one thing, it's always hard to be 16.
I know. I don't want to, seem too teen angsty.
No, I know. Well, it's okay. It's as long as you're not 20s angsty and 30s angsty.
No.
Yeah. No, I mean, when you get to be that age. Because all of a sudden, I mean, if you think about it, well, let me put it another way. You're thinking about it. You're thinking about the world. Before, it was all just kind of family and friends.
Yeah, and everything's pretty solid.
And all of a sudden, boom. Yeah.
It's,
yeah.
Not just that, though. I think I'm more, I see more of the world than other teenagers have. Like, earlier this year, I went to Austria and Czech Republic, and I went to Terezin concentration camp, and just things like that. So even my perception of the war has, you know, really changed. So me still seeing people I know making jokes about Jewish people and, you know, different things like that, it just gets me so mad. And there's no way of me going out and saying things without sounding, you know, pretty pretentious.
Well, Sarah, do you have a group of friends that feel similarly to you, or you feel isolated and alone?
Don't make me seem so teen angsty. I don't know. I feel fairly, like, alone about that. Most people I can talk to are university students that I know.
Well, for one thing, that's okay. I mean, in fact, the man that I went to visit, an old friend of mine who's an elderly man, who's 86 years old, and interestingly, when he began this political process, very long story, in Spain, he was 16 years old. And so all of his friends were 18 and 20 and 24 and 25. But beyond that, there are friends of mine, including this elderly man, just on, when was a couple of days before, there was a demonstration in downtown Windsor against Canada's involvement in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
There is also the Citizens Environment. What is that? I used to host their riverboat tour. All the Citizens Environment something.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard of them?
I've heard of it. I just can't remember the name right now.
Well, okay. But the point being is sometimes they'll come to you. Someone will give you a leaflet. But the best place often to find out things, particularly for young people, is at university. So you just go and you look at those boards and you see, oh, they're having a meeting about the fact that Detroit's incinerator is still just dumping all this crap into the river and into Windsor. And you hook up with it, and suddenly you found, wow, I'm not alone at all. I've got all these people.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not the 1960s, so there's not tens of thousands of people, but a few dozen ain't bad, right?
Yeah. Another thing, I'm an atheist.
Yeah.
Which also I find pretty hard when I was talking to maybe two 20-year-olds, and we were just talking, having a good time, and then I mentioned that I was an atheist, and the conversation just turned so quickly. They just went right against me.
Huh.
And they started having this discussion on why I should find Jesus Christ in my life and all that. And I told them, I have nothing against religion. Whatever gives you faith in your life, that's fine and that's good. It's just I don't really find comfort in religion, and that's not my thing. And yet they thought of me as a different person.
Well, they did this study recently that showed that people, you know, the prejudice against Muslims, particularly in the States, Canada as well.
Teenagers have no idea about religion either.
Well, but let me tell you this.
Muslim confused, and they're just
right.
Totally different.
That people interviewed said they would rather their Christian daughter married a Muslim than an atheist. So it is, in a way, the most hated minority. But there's 20, 30 million of us, for one thing. And then we just realize now 42% of the American people here in the States think they're not even certain that God exists. You go to Europe, nobody goes to church over there. And Bush, as I said, is eroding many people's comfortableness with religion. On the other hand, in the Detroit area, I don't know what it's like other places, is that great numbers of the people that are the bulwark of the peace and social justice movement in the Detroit area are motivated out of their faith. They're faith-based, particularly Christian, particularly Catholics. But all, and you look, you can look on my calendar online, you just see all this stuff that's going on at churches. And they know I don't have any belief. And you know what they say to me about my lack of belief? Nothing. Nothing. What they want to do is they want to, if that is, I mean, I think they probably want everyone to be you know, what brought to Jesus. But what they do, what is it called? Moral witness. In other words, that, and they are admirable people. And the way they connect to each other spiritually is, has an enviable quality to it, to be sure. And that's the way that decent Christian people, decent Muslim, decent Jewish people do things. They're not grabbing you by the collar or trying to kick you out of the community because you're not towing the line. That's, again, part of the fascist mentality. And, Sarah, I got to move on. So thank you very much. But check out some of these groups. I'm sure you'd find lots of friends and be you know, much more welcome than with those two guys you were talking to. Here's Eric in Heartland. Eric, hi. It's Peter Werby, and you're on the air.
Hey, Peter. What's going on?
Hi. What's up?
I went and saw Howard Zinn tonight, and I became very inspired when he was talking about Bush and his relation to and the people that follow President Bush blindly. And he was saying how in relation that is to being fascist, when you have a blind love for your government and you have no willing need to dissent or speak your own personal beliefs, that that is honestly in its roots fascism. And
you know, Eric, your connection is not the best, but hold on. Let me just tell people, Howard Zinn is one of America's most eminent historians. I interviewed him for this show. I think it played like 1 a.m. last Sunday. And his history book, A People's History of the United States, which I almost, you know, I don't want to get really weird on people, but I would almost say to people, if you haven't read Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States, along with the 1,700,000 other people that have bought the book, you're really limited in your scope of understanding of American history. He spoke tonight down at Cobo Hall in Detroit. He received something like the Peacemakers Award for the Cranbrook Peace Foundation. And as far as I understood, Eric, right there, it was sold out, something like 1,500
yeah.
people?
I didn't have a ticket, but they let me in anyway. They're really nice people down there.
I from your voice, you sound like you're not over 25. Am I correct?
Excuse me? Oh, yeah. There was a lady who had us all stand up, and I was one of the people who was under 30, so...
Under okay, because they were letting people 25 and under were able to get
yeah.
them free.
Well, but they sold out, like all the seats were filled, so.
That's absolutely amazing. But if you've never
yeah.
gotten a chance to look at Zinn's book, A People's
mm-hmm.
History of the United States, do it. I mean, most history books, I've known people that have written history books, texts, essentially. And they'll sell, even if they're required for universities, 25,000 or something like that. And if it's a you know a book that's just out there by a publisher on history or on some political issue, it you know, could sell. I mean, some university, when you see these titles from universities, sometimes their press run is even under 1,000. I know a woman who wrote this incredible book about a Michigan personality, very, very interesting book, and... they printed, Wayne State University printed 800 copies. 800, not 800 anything, 800 hardback. Howard Zinn's books has sold 1,700,000, and that doesn't even speak to all the other books. Well, Eric, good. I'm glad you enjoyed.
Well,
yeah.
Well, what I wanted to say is that I felt really inspired, and I'm glad that people like you are out there trying to resolve the truth of what's going on in this world.
Well,
and I wanted to say that I really appreciate what you're doing. So.
Well, thank you. And you know why it looks so different is because this is one of the few places in mainstream commercial radio where they let someone like me on the air. If they said, well, listen, let's be fair. Let's get as many people from each point of view as possible equally, I would be drowned in this stampede of maybe 100 other talk show hosts just like me, except what they do is they control because, you know, there's great corporate control of the media. All right, Eric, glad you liked it. And if people still don't know what we're talking about, it's Zinn, Z-I-N-N, Howard Zinn. And I can see that we are having the same problem disconnecting our phones. Al, even though I told our stalwart... what do you call it, staff? That reminded me of something else I wanted to read. But, man, everybody wants to talk about elections. So let's do it. Let's go to the person who's been hanging on the most. It's Chuck in Waterford. Chuck, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Pete. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to get your opinion and make a quick observation. I know 2 years ago, I was confident that Bush was going to be put out in a landslide. Then I saw a Bush sticker on a car, and I actually laughed out loud, and I saw Bush signs popping up everywhere along my drive to work, and, well, we know what happened.
Right.
Now, this year, I'm confident that the majority of Michigan voters aren't going to be fooled by Dick DeVos's propaganda campaign.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing Dick DeVos signs all along the drive to and from work, and I'm thinking, you know, there's a lot of weak-minded people out there thinking maybe change would be good, and maybe people don't realize that, you know, the governor's office is not responsible for the poor decisions these executives made in the years past.
The auto execs, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's a scary thing. What happens if,
Granholm,
Dick actually wins?
And Granholm is not responsible for the deficit that she inherited from John Engler either. Well, right now she's way up in the polls. I understand what you're saying. A lot of times people, the polls aren't quite as accurate as people think. But the reason you see so much DeVos thing is this guy's a multimillionaire, and he has spent millions and millions and millions of dollars. And she has just taken off in the last few days. What do I think is going to happen? I don't know. He's a far right wing conservative.
It would be a disaster for us if he wins.
It would be a total disaster. Yeah. And I think the majority of Michigan people are going to go for that. Go to my website if you want to see some incredible exposés of him, including one that was written by, put together by a couple of friends of mine, one who wrote it, Kurt Guyette, who's the news editor of the Metro Times, wonderful guy. And then also my other friend who I actually talked to on the phone the other day, Russ Ballant, B-A-L-L-A-N-T. And I love the name of the article, You Don't Know Dick. All right, Chuck, we shall see Tuesday night. I'm going to play handball as usual. Then we will go to our usual watering hole and sit there and cheer on the demise of this racket that we've been saddled with for so long. All right, here is Todd. Todd's in Holly. Todd, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Doing good.
Hey, last caller is very similar to my question. Where is the best place to go for, I'll call it the uninformed, to find everything out about the candidates that are running, the different proposals that are up for vote? My wife and myself, we're not news people. We hate the news. It's a downer, you know. It's depressing to see and hear murder and rape and
sure.
Just everything in the country. And with all the mudslinging between the candidates and that, we really like to find a good place. And hopefully everyone else, you know, this will help as well. Where's the best place to go for all that information?
That's an excellent question, because I actually voted absentee. And I'm looking at these proposals, and sometimes they sound good. And then they find out that they're not. But somebody suggested, and do you use a computer?
Oh, definitely.
Okay, League of Women Voters. The League of Women Voters, and they're nonpartisan, and what they do is and maybe people can call in, and they can give us even better suggestions. If you want partisan stuff, obviously go to the Republican Party. Go to the UAW site. Go to the Democratic Party site. Go to the individual candidate site. But you might, if you want something where it's going to pretty much just present both sides, something like the League of Women Voters would probably be best.
Okay.
All right. Great.
Thanks.
Great question. Thank you very much. Anybody else have any idea? Now, see, I've made up my mind. I'm partisan. I am way partisan. And if I wanted to find out how, I'm not going to just go lockstep. And I don't feel so badly now. I just couldn't bring myself to vote for Debbie Stabenow. So I voted for the Green candidate for Senate. And I'm thinking, whoa, man. I mean, maybe she's alienated tons of people like me, you know, so she didn't voted for all this Bush stuff because she didn't want to look weak on terrorism or something like that. I've kind of made up my mind on most of the issues. But I don't mean that everyone should, and it's good. I mean, it's good to kind of reexamine your beliefs. All right, let's continue on. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. I haven't even looked at my email. calltalkyes@yahoo.com. calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Let's see. Here is Ashley. Ashley is in South Lyon. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Okay. So you had somebody earlier saying something about the younger generation these days and stuff. Well, you have something like MTV, who is an amazingly growing empire for the younger generation.
Okay.
And then you get people like Paris Hilton and Puff Daddy and just all these big, humongous stars get on there and say, vote or die, choose or lose, this or that or the other. And, of course, the younger generation is very impressionable, and they, of course, are going to follow somebody that they look up to.
Uh-huh.
But little do they know that most of these people that are saying, you know, vote or die and this or that and the other are Republicans, and that's what's killing the earth. And then you have people like, I'm pretty sure it was Bouchard, who goes and gets Kid Rock to help out his campaign. And you got these younger people who are going, sweet, you know, he's got Kid Rock, you know, yeah, yeah, great, cool. But they're not looking at how he could ruin things. They're looking at it as, sweet, he's got Kid Rock. I'm for him.
I got to tell you, Ashley, that is an extremely excellent observation. I mean, it means so little to me who endorses. I mean, sometimes organizations, if they're organizations that I support, and they've looked at the person's candidacy and they like his positions and they're like the ones that they hold and I support the organization, that's one thing. But if every big star on earth, as they've brought out in a lot of these elections, because most rock stars and most TV stars and movie stars are Democrats. I mean, you find a few right wingers like Kid Rock and Bruce Willis and Ted Nugent. There's got to be a couple more. You know, the guy that played, I can't even think, played the psychiatrist on television. What was that? I don't know. Anyway, I don't think I've ever seen the show all the way through. But so there's a few of them. So, people that are going, oh, Bill Clinton supports this person, so I'm going to vote for him. Or, oh, Kid Rock. That's dumb. It is dumb. And thank you for bringing that up. I got to go do some commercials right now. Thank you so much. We'll be right back. Pretty light load tonight, so we'll be back in a minute and a half.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
And to fear the flame and to burn a crowd that has a name. And to right or wrong, and to meek or strong, it is known to scream from the wall.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Hey, at 1 o'clock, about an hour and 2 minutes, I'm going to be interviewing Dave Marsh, an old pal from Detroit. He's the biographer of Bruce Springsteen, and he has a great new book out called Bruce Springsteen on Tour, 1965-2005. You're thinking, wait a minute, I thought this was a political show. Well, When Dave and me talk about rock and roll, it gets that way. And also talk about more about immigration. Man, can you believe that people are still stressing over that? I mean, something has to be done. In fact, this woman I interview is extraordinary. You know everything you need to know about immigration. I thought I did. And she just knocked me off my feet. I mean, she says the whole system's broken. There's no doubt about that. I don't mean to say there's not a problem at all. Let me see. Is there open line? Maybe one open line. 313-298-WRIF. And let's see. Let's go to Jeff in Windsor. Jeff, hi. It's Peter Werby, and you're on the air.
Hello, Pete. This is Jeff from Windsor.
Hi.
I just want to give kudos to the young lady that called earlier. I can remember when I made my political awakening was, I think I was in my 30s. She made hers at 16, she said?
Yeah.
That's pretty good for her.
Okay. I think so.
As you were saying?
Well, I was going to say, any suggestions of where she could... Where should she go in Windsor?
You know what? I got my political awakening from listening to your show. So where she gets hers from, I mean, I have no idea. I couldn't help her out any way, shape, or form. Just carry on whatever she's doing.
Well, I'll tell you, Jeff, I'm pleased to do that. But one of the things that we have to do is move beyond the confines of just our own brains and move into political action. And there are things that are really interesting. Like I took this, the bus was only about half filled, too. I don't know whether they did enough publicity or what. But it was an extraordinarily interesting tour where they did this labor history tour of Windsor. And we went you'd probably know the place, but there were all these ethnic halls that were scattered all around Windsor. Many of them are still there, where people then, I mean, talk about where you could send someone. In Windsor, 40, 50, 60, 70 years ago, and you'd say, hey, what nationality are you? And you'd say Polish, Ukrainian, Jewish, German, Italian. And you'd say, oh, go to the Italian hall. They'd say, wait a minute, are you left wing or right wing? You'd say left wing. You'd say, oh, you go to this Italian hall. Whereas now, there's not a lot like that. Some of these halls, there are some still left. Most of them, they rent them out for weddings. But there was a great public presence that people weren't sitting home watching television and surfing the web. That social life was exactly that. That people came together in a community and enjoyed themselves. These halls also. I mean, they just sit around and talk about politics. They put on plays. They had music. They did readings. It was an extraordinarily lively, popular culture. Popular in the sense of that it came right from the people. Now,
yeah, you can find fun things here.
Yeah, I like Windsor a lot.
There was another one I wanted to get on to about politicians. How corporations, they can take your job away from you, but don't the politicians create tax environments to allow either your jobs either to stay in this country or to work someplace else or to leave your country?
Well, the deal is, Jeff, that the biggies never have to pay the cost for their mistakes. Whether it's war or company decisions, it's always the average man and woman that gets screwed, while the Mr. Big always just walks on to the next little venue and doesn't even bother to say sorry about that. All right, Jeff, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. There's so many things. Why am I forgetting? There's something. Oh, Iraq. That's right. How can we forget about that? One of the things that's going on, how we're being looted. That instead of taking care of business at home, instead of trying to make this country democratic and having confidence in the voting machines and stuff like that, and instead of building up this country, we should be building up Iraq because we destroyed it. But, of course, none of this is happening. Billions and billions and billions of dollars have been stolen. Now, there was this inspector general who was a Republican lawyer named Stuart Bowen. And he worked in these Republican administrations before, and he started finding out what was going on. So he sent American occupation officials to jail on bribery and conspiracy charges. He exposed disastrously poor construction work by well-connected companies like Halliburton and Parsons. And he discovered that the military did not properly track hundreds of thousands of weapons it shipped to Iraqi security forces. So what happened to all these weapons? Well, they're being used against our troops, of course. So here is a man doing the job that an inspector general does within government. Find out whether people are following the laws that Congress have put forth to govern certain activity. So what does Bush Co. does? That's Bush Incorporated, Bush and Sons Incorporated, turning government into a 100% racket that is financed by you and me. That's why I can't understand why there is a single Republican left in the country that makes under $300,000. If there's any under $50,000, I mean, I don't know. I don't want to insult anybody that badly. Guess what Bush Co. did? They inserted into the military spending bill, into this huge military authorization statute that he signed 2 weeks ago, that they abolished the position of inspector general. So we're not going to have nosy Stuart Bowen around, nosing around in Iraq, finding out that Halliburton and Bechtel and Parsons and these mercenaries and all these other companies are stealing our money, keeping track of nothing, and that the vast majority of the money is paid to Iraqis doing nothing. And what do they say? Well, I don't mind. I don't mind that at all. All right. Here's Wayne in Sterling Heights. Wayne, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. Great show.
Good, thanks.
I found a nonpartisan website with it shows you your ballot. You just put in your name. It shows you the ballot you're going to be looking at. It shows you you can get links to the candidates' websites where they get their funding for their campaign, and a whole bunch of information about all of them. It's Publius.com, P-U-B-L-I-U-S, and that's what I went to.
All right, well, thank you. I appreciate that very much. I'm going to have, why is that doing that? I see why that's doing that. That's right, we got a new way to get rid of it. Good. Why do I suspect something here? In fact, let's see here. We'll see whether this is the case. Okay, Publius.com. Or is it turn out to be... okay, anyway, he was joking. I'm sorry. My apologies to you. I thought this was going to turn out to be a porn site or something like that. Let me see, though. Could this be... Because when you put your name and address on there... All right. I'm going to put, let me see if we can do this. I'll put on there Joseph Stalin. And we'll see what it says here. What does it do? It's processing. The database has no record of any registered voters with the name you have entered. Please check the field below. Okay, so maybe this is legit. This is cool. All right, let's go back to our phones, 313-298-WRIF, and here's Paul. Paul's in Brighton. Paul, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Doing great, thanks.
Oh, you know, I'm looking at the paper one day, and I can't believe they put it in the middle of the corner. We recycle. I have the paper here. But I read it. I also had a witness with me. And, you know, this is the geologist and the ecologist from London and all, they've been around for a lot. Remember, they discovered America. These people know what's going on. They are saying that we're going to kill ourselves. They're basically, what we're doing to the planet is going to be worse than all the wars that we could ever do to this country. And it scares me to death. But we've been warned. Everybody's been warned. Nobody's listening. And when something happens finally, what are they going to do? Oh, no, we got to correct this.
Well, Paul, it gets back to, in a sense, in an odd way, to Sarah from Windsor. What do you do? I mean, somebody might be sitting in the house next to you, hearing the same information and thinking nobody's responding to this because they're not knowing that you're doing it. I mean, what we don't do is involve ourselves directly and actively in defending now the planet. I mean, on one hand, we were being attacked on our standard of living and a hundred other ways that with this gang in power now. But fundamentally, they are setting back any effort that it was even possible, even with faint ones like the Kyoto Treaty that Bush won't even sign on to, which right now there should be something, you know, the Manhattan Project that put together the atomic bomb to say we are going to end use of oil in the on the planet, period, by 2010 or 2012. What they say now is we're going to reduce emissions by 2% by 2015. So these aren't even Band-Aids. These are just trying to deal with a problem that appears insurmountable. And it appears insurmountable because there is this institutionalization of the way we're operating now. There's a paradigm that exists that is a petrochemical nuclear industrial system that is choking the planet and going to destroy it, just as you said. Absolutely as you said. And when you and there's a couple of things. First, you go, it sounds like Chicken Little because you're saying the sky is going to fall. Well, we start seeing that in terms of these ozone holes that, in fact, the sky is falling. We find out that the fisheries could collapse. And I was saying, I think it was even last week, that a lot of that ecologically, you don't have to kill you know, everything one by one. The passenger pigeons in the United States, that when they came here, they were there was billions of them, literally billions of them, that they would block out the sun sometimes when they flew. But they were killed in such numbers that when their population, even though they still were tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions, their population crashed. And we now, with our overpopulation of the Earth, are doing something that is, well, not similar to the passenger pigeon, but we could hit a critical mass where the pressure on the planet and the demand for resources is and the pollution and everything from that is so dramatic that we're going to get to a point of no return. So I agree with you completely that it probably is the biggest problem facing us. Yeah.
You can't argue with somebody if you agree.
Oh, yeah.
It's really hard to do, isn't it?
Well, it is. But here's the other point, that right now that the problem is of such magnitude that no one knows even how to approach it. And I can say these things. I mean, actually, it would be fairly easy. We could end the need for nuclear power within a year if we went on a conservation program that did things like just substitute fluorescent lights for incandescent lights. We could get rid of oil and the need for natural gas by putting in solar panels, wind power, all of that. And there are some people that say, oh, there's not enough energy that can be generated from alternative sources. Well, we just got to do less. What I mean by that is, we have a choice. We can either foul our nest, or we can maybe cut back a little of the way we live. In other words, we don't have to have, I can't even begin to tell you how many lights are in this studio, maybe about 20 or something like that. And our grandparents didn't have that. You ever have had your electricity?
Slowly but surely.
Yeah.
They're not going to care about me or you.
Hey, Paul, you ever had your electricity updated in your house?
Yes, sir, I have.
And what's one of the things that you can tell is they put in a lot more electrical outlets, right? Yeah, because in our some of their houses, like my house was built in 1942 or 40 or something like that, and they didn't, they didn't have coffee makers and microwaves and blenders and toasters and stuff like that. So we have exponentially grown how much energy needs we have. And they say, well, what do you want? You want to take that all away, man? You want to start making toast by holding it over the gas flame? Well, no, of course. I want to live like I am. But given choices, strangling the planet or doing things a little differently or not quite to the extent that we have been seems like a better choice. Paul, thank you for bringing up something so important. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. And let's see, I guess I pressed Matt from Warren without realizing it. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How you doing?
Doing well, thanks.
Hey, it's the first time I caught your show, and I'm pretty intrigued by it. I'm glad I turned on the rip.
Well, thank you.
I just wanted to bring up, you know, why do people let things like, you know, gun laws and, you know, religion and all this other stuff, you know, make such a big influence on them for, you know, for voting? And when that stuff, I don't know, that stuff really doesn't seem to pertain to me for, you know, how the country is run.
Well, let me ask you a question. I mean, I do have an idea, but any ideas or any suspicions of what's motivating them?
I mean, all right, I'm a liberal, okay? I mean, I'm left wing, okay? But, you know, I'm more toward the right side of the left wing. You know, I like guns, you know, and I like my cars and gas-burning vehicles and stuff like that, you know? And I just don't understand why, you know, why people, especially the Republicans, why do they so strongly, like, religion is the biggest one, why do they so strongly, you know, have to, you know, vote for somebody just for religion when, you know, that has nothing to do with running the country.
Well,
you know?
They think it does, which I would agree with you, that it not only doesn't it, but it shouldn't. And when it has, it's always been a disaster. I always used to say, one nation under God, Iran, or one nation under God, Saudi Arabia, or something like that. And or one nation under God, England or France or countries like that back in the Middle Ages. That's what the Founding Fathers wanted to get away from. That's why they made this a secular nation. That's why they have this wall between the church and the state. That's why the first thing it says in the First Amendment is that Congress shall make no law establishing religion. But I think partly it is. There's people here that I work with that I was astounded when they told me they voted for Bush. And frequently what they say is, you know, these guys are all the same, but I care about abortion. And so if Kerry is pro-choice and Bush is compulsory pregnancy, I'm going to go with the compulsory pregnancy because they say in the long run there's no difference. And, you know, it used to kind of be the case that you could really make the case that there was absolutely no difference between the two parties. It was Tweedledum and Tweedledummer. And yet today, I think that that there's a startling difference, and there's an enormous decision to be made here. Maybe once the Democrats get in power, they're going to not. I mean, what are they going to do? I mean, they have so much to roll back that that Bush has done. I don't think they could do it in 2 years, and they don't have a president that will sign anything. Say they want to reestablish the arsenic standards that Bush rolled back. You know, you can go to, pardon me, you can go to a website called Thousand Reasons. I think that's the name. It's on my website, thousandreasons.org. And it's absolutely astounding that that there is that many. Let's see here. I'm gonna go to it right now. Actually, it's up to 1,453. It's thousandreasons.org. Thousandreasons.org. And it just goes right down the list of these crimes that have been committed on the body politic by Bushko. And as like I say, I'm not real enthusiastic about the Democrats, but to leave these guys in power is just going to be an extraordinary disaster. All right, thank you very much. Thanks for being a first-time listener and caller. Please do it again. We shall talk again. Why am I doing this? Am I putting these people next on the lines? Jim from Dearborn. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
How you doing?
Good. What's up?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the Saddam trial.
Sure.
Real quick. Because it was, what he was convicted of was killing 148 people for an assassination attempt on him.
Right.
And so I was just wondering, because didn't Clinton bomb Iraq when Saddam allegedly tried to assassinate the first Bush in 93? So the Clinton trial is going to start when?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's Piker stuff. The Clinton and Gore illegally bombing, and then Bush, too, bombing Iraq, killed thousands of Iraqis. And the sanctions that they imposed on this country, which did nothing to erode Saddam's rule or to stop his opulent lifestyle, they estimate killed up near a million Iraqis. And Bush has not even gotten up to that. He's up to about 600,000. If we give him a little more time, maybe he'll, you know.
Well, yeah, but there's a lot more depleted uranium there now, too.
Yeah, well, yeah.
So there'll be millions by the time they're done there. But it's just, if Clinton did the same thing Saddam did, and Bush killed 600 people in Fallujah when they killed the Blackwater people, so I just wonder, since Saddam's going to be executed, when do their trials start?
Well, march them all off, as far as I'm concerned, march them all off to the Hague. There's a button out, and you think, oh, this is a little extreme or something like that. It says U.S. out of the Middle East. U.S. out of the Middle East. And I can't imagine something that would make better sense. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. I had something else in here. All right. So why did we go to war in Iraq? Well, there was weapons of mass destruction. Oh, no, there weren't any there. They were complicit in 9/11. No, weren't there. Oh, we're going to establish democracy. Somehow or other, Bush came up with it finally. Bush and all these guys, they go on these far right-wing talk shows. This is amazing. Can you imagine if there was a Democratic president and all he or she did was to go to liberal talk shows? I mean, people would be screaming bloody murder. But here's, so he was on Rush Limbaugh show, he being Bush. I can't remember the date. Last week, I think. During an interview with conservative pundit Rush Limbaugh, U.S. President George Bush expressed deep concerns about the possibility of the United States leaving the Middle East, raising fears that extremists could topple governments. That was more to the sentence. So he's concerned that they will topple governments. Usually they say it can be a base for terrorists. Well, we've assured that. Yeah, well, we haven't. Bush has assured that. Here's the rest of the sentence. Raising fears that extremists could topple governments to control oil resources. It's an oil war. All these people, hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, thousands of Americans, 20,000 American wounded, are all to secure oil for this insatiable machine that Bush and the rest of his gangster cronies sit at the top of. That's why these people have got to go. Hey, what's your opinion on this? Is it as strong as mine? You disagree? 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. All right, Al, should I take this line 4 here? It doesn't have anyone's name on it. When you get done talking, try putting it back on hold. Okay. Should I take that? But he doesn't even know how to get a hold of me. Maybe our little system here isn't working. All right, let's try Joe in Canton. Joe, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Peter?
Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing good.
I want to thank you so much for all you do for, Michigan.
Well, thank you.
I love your talk show. I've been listening for a couple of years, and I tape it for several people, like my brother who works midnights and a friend of mine in California who I mail the tapes out to.
Wow.
And you have formed some good opinions.
Hey, you do know that this is iPodded through WRIF, right?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
But the one out in California works late nights, too, so
okay.
They can't get it because it's a work.
All right, great.
I want to thank you, too, for kicking me kind in the butt. You know, you always talk about, change things, do something about it.
Yeah.
And I did. And now I've been actively helping with the Democrat Party, calling people, being proactive instead of being lame duck sitting in my butt doing nothing.
That's good. Be sure, though, these elections come around every 2 years and the big ones only every 4 years.
Correct.
That sometimes there's a tendency to do nothing in between. So there's a lot has to be done. And most of these groups that are looking to establish peace and social justice, defending our civil liberties and our civil rights, they need help year-round, year in and year out. So
I agree, too.
Yeah, I'm not being critical of you. I'm more...
Oh, no,
yeah,
not at all.
Yeah, right.
But about an earlier caller called about, blaming Gina for Graham Holmes, you've got to, the person has to remember, she's got to deal with the Republican House.
And Senate.
she can't get anything done when they try to block everything.
Sure.
With people like, you know, it's just all her opposition people. I'll just say that. Because I can go into names, but I won't do that right now. But I just want to thank you for all you do and all that you've done.
Thank you, Joe.
We need more people like you.
Well, thank you so much.
All right, take care.
Appreciate it. Very nice of you to say that. Let me see. We got a new system here that we're trying to use. Well, I guess that doesn't work either. This is insane. You know what? Never mind. This is. Do other talk shows have this problem? I don't know. Here's Nick. Nick's in Toledo. Nick, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Doing good.
I just have a question on what you just said about oil war.
Yeah.
You're thinking that, is that the main reason you think Bush went to war? Oil?
Yeah.
Really? Do you think he lied about weapons of mass, he really didn't think there were weapons of mass destruction?
He doesn't seem, I think that.
Or ties to Al-Qaeda or anything like that?
I mean, I don't know whether, I mean, the other people that were saying, I mean, Cheney sure knew it was a lie, Rumsfeld and Powell and Edelman and all the rest of those guys that put it all forth. Yeah, they knew there were none. How did I know?
Well, not you personally, but I mean, do you think that? Because
I think they were lying. I don't think it was false intelligence. I think they were purposely lying. Yeah,
right. Because you know, like several Democrats, including John Kerry, is one out there, said that he believed they had weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah, so did Hillary Clinton. They voted for the war resolution.
So do you think John Kerry and Hillary Clinton lied too?
Yep. Yeah, I think they're opportunistic politicians who were seeing a potential run for the presidency and didn't want to be saddled with an opponent, a Republican opponent, saying they refused to attack Saddam Hussein. They probably believed the Republican deal that we were just going to walk right in there and they're going to welcome us with flowers and everything like that. No, I think the Democrats that voted for that war resolution, which includes Kerry, which includes Hillary Clinton, which includes, I'm trying to think who else, was just absolutely despicable. Fortunately for us, both Debbie Stabenow and Levin voted against it. But now, but when it comes up to election time, then you have Debbie Stabenow voting for this Military Commissions Act, voting for this wall that's not even going to ever be built, voting for the bankruptcy bill, voting for a flag amendment. And you're saying, well, you don't want Bouchard in there. Well, Bouchard would have voted the exact same way that Debbie Stabenow voted.
I see.
Go ahead.
I just want to know your opinion on that because, you know, I just wanted to know what you thought about, you know, Kerry and all them, but I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think that they bear great responsibility for the war. There was particularly so because they could have provided leadership. They should have been out in the streets. They should have been. Hillary Clinton is the senator from New York. My wife and I flew all the way to New York in a bitter winter of 2003 to take part in a million-person demonstration in New York City saying no to war a month before it began. Hillary Clinton should have been leading that. But she was thinking, well, I'm going to be running for the presidency in 2008, and I already voted for the war, so I can't really do that, so I'm just going to go somewhere else. So the fact that she would not provide leadership, the fact that John Kerry wouldn't, I think Edwards voted for the war as well. So I hold them in good part responsible for that as well. I mean, of course, when they see public opinion changing, gee, guess what? They go with the wind.
Right.
That's why I'm not a Democrat.
Mm.
Okay?
Well, yes.
All right, Nick, thank you for joining me. You know what I think, too, what is so terrible about this? When people hear me, because as I said, people from the center to the left have a high degree of integrity. And when they think, well, yeah, if these people are that bad, that opportunistic, just barely better than the Republicans, why should I even bother? Where's the Republicans mean? You know, ask if you know any Republicans, say, what has George Bush done wrong? And some of them now at least will say he screwed up the war or something like that. But a year or two ago,
2 years ago, 3 years ago, say, what has George Bush ever done wrong? You silence. Yes, Democrats. What has Clinton done wrong? And it'd go, and you say, man, Monica Lewinsky? That is, you know, that's like zero, nothing other than the guy. I mean, forget about that. I mean, the Communications Act, I can't even remember all this stuff that I'd have to go back and look at my notes. But liberals are very critical of the Clinton era. I mean, some of them tend to go, oh, this was the golden age. Everything was wonderful. It was better. It was better. And we weren't run by a bunch of psychos and hypocrites and corrupt officials like we are now. But, you know, the Democrats are nothing to run home, write home about. But what happens when we hear that? We go, yeah, what the hell? I'm not going to vote for those people. But you can run out the 1,453 crimes that Bushko has committed that are on that website I mentioned earlier, 1000reasons.org, and a true blue Republican, it won't affect them in the slightest. It won't affect them in the slightest. All right, let's go to Jack. Jack is in Toledo. Jack, hi, it's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that Haggard guy. What do you think that was that drummed up by the left? Do you think it was kind of concocted?
No.
I think it is because, I mean, Democrats, aren't they supposed to be for people, you know, people's freedoms and people to have sexual relationships? And even I know there's a lot of liberals that are even for people to do drugs.
Well, yes, while having gay sex. I don't care if people do drugs while they're having gay sex. But I do care if someone is such a hypocrite that he's leading the anti-gay marriage amendment in Denver and talking about the scourge of drugs all the while he's snorting crystal meth and having gay sex while he's married and have five kids. It is political. Mike Jones, who was the gay man who had been a prostitute, said he's not any longer, who was on some talk show, somebody was telling me, and they said, well, isn't this political? And he said, you're damn right it was political. He said, all of a sudden I remembered the John that was coming to me, that was paying me for the drugs, that was paying me for the sex, was this man that was leading a movement in Colorado that would make me less than a human being, and damn, I was going to go out and expose his ass, and good for Mike Jones. And I'm glad that he took old Ted Haggard down, aren't you?
Is Mike Jones going to be running for office, do you think?
I have no idea. I doubt it. I don't think they're going to be. I don't think gay male prostitutes have much of a future as politicians. Do you?
Well, I think he could. I mean, you know, I think he's. I mean, that would be the only reason that he should really claim that.
Well, okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Let's take a break, and we'll be right back. 313-298-WRIF. That's our phone number. It's 313-298-9743. Call talkyes at yahoo.com is the email address here.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days, every 6 months, for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Radio Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in a contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220. This is WRIM 90.
And during the few moments that we have left, we want to talk right down to earth in a language that everybody here can easily understand.
Look. Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. This is our last segment of talk, but of phone it. But at 1 o'clock, I'm going to be talking with Dave Marsh about his brand new book about Bruce Springsteen tours, and Marsh, old pal from Detroit, has amazing takes on a lot of stuff having to do with music. So stay tuned for that. Also, a guest about immigration that really surprised me. I mean, I learned a lot from her. So, yeah, it's the kind of thing where I think, oh, yeah, I know that. But I didn't know it as well as I thought I did. All right, let's go back to our phones, 313-298-WRIF. And let's see, this is Dave. Dave, hi, where are you calling from?
Warren.
Okay, go ahead. You're on the air.
Great. Hi, Peter.
Yeah, you know what? I'm not going to hang up or anything, but I forgot to say that, for speaking about Warren, Night Call is brought to you this hour by Waking Up, Metro Detroit's sweatshop free clothing store, located in the Universal Mall at 12 Mile Road in DeQuinder in Warren.
Uh-huh.
And you can go to wakingupstore.com, and they're having a sale called Get a Jump on the Holidays. It's happening the 6th through the 12th. Everything in the store, 15% off, 20% for union members. I owed him that. Sorry. Go ahead.
No problem. Yeah, I was just thinking, you know, about the election.
Yeah.
It just seems to me like back before the war started, I had the same feeling, like a bad feeling, you know.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking, like this election is more important than you know, more recent ones.
Yeah, I agree.
So even your previous caller was looking for information, you know, where's all the proposals and where's all the laws that they want to do.
Uh-huh.
So that's really not easily done, is it? I mean, I'm sure there's a website from the state, but.
Well, there is this Publius, P-U-B-I-L,
yeah,
P-U-B-L-I-I-U, I can't. Publius.
You're right.
Yeah, I had it, but wait a minute, here it is. I can't spell out loud. I never could. Is that weird?
I mean, I read the paper and stuff every day, but still, what are you going to do, read their editorials, you know?
Here it is. It's P-U-B-L-I-U-S, P-U-B-L-I-U-S .com, right? You put your name. You got to be a registered voter, apparently, because I tried to put in Joseph Stalin,
uh-huh,
and it wouldn't take it.
Mm-hmm.
Said no, nothing in the database about it.
Well, since you're on your computer, why don't you go to Google and type in miserable failure?
I've done that. I'll let other people.
I thought I'd mention that.
All right. That's good. Thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it. Yeah, type in Google, put in miserable failure. I think you have to put in I feel lucky as well. Here's Geraldo in Detroit, or is it Geraldo?
Close enough, however you pronounce it.
Okay.
You know, but your name is Peter, so I can say it that easy.
Go ahead.
Well, you know what, as according to like past callers there, especially the one regarding firearms and religion, just hearing the callers and hearing him, in my Bible, I thought that God's chosen people were the Israelites and not the Republicans. but most of them, if you notice, like especially for the past couple elections, especially major elections, you know, they were always pushing for, if you're a true Christian, then you got to be on our side, the Republicans, you know. But it's just like, look at what they've resorted to now. For one, okay, like the other caller, she said Kid Rock. But Kid Rock has admitted of being a drug user, mainly marijuana,
mm-hmm,
you know, and marijuana is still illegal in this country. Mr. Bouchard, Debbie Stabenow does not have an admitted drug user backing her up. And DeVos.
Yeah, I didn't vote for him.
Yeah, and DeVos, he actually went to a religious, very large religious established, plain and simple, a large church in Detroit. I've actually attended there a few times and even have put in their collection plate. I don't know if I can say their name or not, but he actually had...
Was it the World...
Detroit World Outreach.
Yeah.
And pretty well much, I prayed about it and I said, Lord, I don't think I mean, I couldn't understand why I didn't feel about not going to them for a while, because DeVos actually went there with Giuliani, an admitted adulterer. And remember, the Republicans crucified, forgive me for the pun, crucified Bill Clinton, saying that he's evil, he's not like us, because he's an adulterer.
They're monumental frauds. I'll tell you, Geraldo, what they probably would. What Clinton? I mean, Clinton was a jerk. He was a jerk for thinking he could pull that off in the first place. Although so was Ted Haggard and Mark Foley and the rest of them. But certainly the president is mostly under the microscope. On the other, it didn't used to be like that. John Kennedy, they think, had sex with Marilyn Monroe in the White House. They think he did LSD before it was illegal in the White House. I was just reading a biography of Timothy Leary. But now you're really under scrutiny. And what Clinton should have said is, my private life is absolutely none of your business. And what you're asking me is between my wife and me, and get out of my face, because right now we are dealing with Blue Dadi. But he started, I did not have sex with that woman. Did you like, too, Ted Haggard said he bought that crystal meth, but he didn't use it. You know, it's like Clinton. That's another thing. Clinton says, you know, I inhaled, or, you know, what, he smoked marijuana.
Yeah, he tried it, but he didn't inhale.
Didn't inhale. Oh, yeah, man, come
yeah,
on.
But you know what? I mean, despite whatever a lot of religious people and televangelists and all these strong religious leaders, I have to really applaud, and one of the best examples I can use, for what even the Bible says, Hillary Clinton, because she actually does what the Republicans and these church leaders don't do. She forgave Bill Clinton. I mean, she stuck to, for better, for worse, sickness and health, you know, the whole nine yards. I mean, it was out in public. I mean, she could have, you know, she could have taken a baseball bat and did a Maglio Ordonez on him, you know. But, you know, but the thing was, it's like, obviously, if they're still together, they're together. I mean, look at what happened to Angelina and Pitt. You know, I mean, what's her name? Jennifer Aniston. She just...
I don't know, Geraldo. I think you're being too kind to her. I mean, I think that they're, you know, they're both, what's the word, ambitious people, and that motivates a lot of their decisions. I mean, they're politicians. I mean, it's not like I'm bringing up some new information about them. And they probably thought, hey, this is going to look pretty bad if we divorce. On the other hand, you don't hear her or him going out with anybody, so I don't know, maybe they do got it back together. Certainly, there's been enough infidelity in the world among all people of all political persuasions that have let it pass by. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. All right. We got another call to take here. We're having a tad a problem here. That's why I'm a little indecisive with this, if I sound a little distracted, which I am. All right. Here's Tina in West Bloomfield. Tina, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Doing good.
I was calling one of your callers a while ago, called about the environment.
Right.
And I wanted to call because I had read this article in Time magazine about how they found higher counts of mercury in all the animals. And they said that the smoke out of the factories, you know, lets out mercury. And when it lands in the water, it changes its chemical. It's chemistry, and it becomes methyl mercury, I think.
Okay.
And then it becomes absorbed in the body because it's changed. Like, but anyways, I think the biggest problem with the best way we could change things is through the small, like, when you go shopping, all the stores now are mega stores.
Right.
So you go in there, and you only need one thing, but you end up getting other things.
Uh-huh.
You know, and they do it, you know, and all the advertising on TV, you know, makes you think you need all these things in order to be happy.
All
so,
right.
Anyways, I send my kids to a Waldorf school. I don't know if you've ever heard of Waldorf schools.
Sure. Sure, of course.
And at those schools, they teach the kids basic self-sufficiency, where they're not dependent. Like, they make bowls out of wood as a project. They do knitting. Everything's done by hand. They cook their own food. And so the children are learning not to be dependent.
Well, yeah,
and the corporations as much because they can make the things themselves, you know.
Well, they're learning a worldview, which is very important. Waldorf schools are excellent. But let me say that I think that personal choice is excellent, and I try to do it as much as possible. But ultimately, it has to take on, and I'm not putting this on you or me, or because it's not here yet. This has to take on mass proportions. Because small individual,
right? The government should be doing something.
Well, I agree. That's what I was saying. That the government ought to be committed to getting off of oil, say in the next 5 years or something like that. And probably there's a lot of people saying that's impossible. Well, maybe it is, but why don't we give it a whirl so we don't fight any more wars over oil, and we don't have any more oil spills, and we don't have any more pollution from it burning, and we don't have any more benzene factories destroying the atmosphere and the lives, the physical lives of the people that work in them, on and on and on like that. We could do it. It's the people but institutions besides, just, it's not just that they're greedy at the top or that they, but people can't see beyond the reigning paradigm. It has to come from outside. It has to be a revolutionary, a turning over of what kind of institutions we currently have. And right now, as you've said, Tina, and other people, I think it was Paul said, that we're on the highway to hell, as AC/DC sings, and we better figure out some way to get off it. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Some point, I want to give some props to Bob Seger. He's got a great new album out. And where the hell is the album? Yeah, I have lost everything tonight, haven't I? All right, well, I'm far away from the microphone. He's got a great anti-war song. Anybody notice that on this new Seger album, Face the Promise? There on his big chopper. Or his Harley, at least. It's called No More. We'll play that before the show ends, though. All right, let's go. So we should go through your calls pretty quickly, then. Here's Rob in Auburn. Rob, hi. You're on the air.
Hello, Peter. I just wanted to back up what the caller said back a while ago, and another caller just recently brought up about the Pubilus.
Yeah.
It's a great website, and I'd never heard of it, and I really appreciate the caller pointing it out, because I've been looking for ballot information, and unfortunately up here in Bay County, they do not offer, the League of Women Voters do not offer something online, information online. So I'm sure you can get something if you go to the library or whatever, but anyway, that is a great website. It gives ballot information from what I can tell, I'm assuming for every community in Michigan.
Oh, that's great. Yeah,
yeah.
I didn't know about it either, and the only way I dealt with some of these ballot proposals, I said I already voted absentee, is that I called friends that were, you know, like the one about education. I called a guy I know, and because, like I said, sometimes you read them and you try to make sense of them and you figure...
Well, let me back up a second. It doesn't... It basically just showing what the ballot looks like. It's not going to explain it. At least if it did, I didn't see that part. But at least you can, you know, do a little more research online if you want before you go in.
Oh, okay. Well, to me, what's important would be to hear the arguments on both sides of it.
Well, if they've got that, I didn't get that far yet. But,
right.
But I just thought it was at least nice to know going in ahead of time. I can know exactly what I'm looking at when I get in there.
Yeah, that is good. All right, Rob, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Yeah, it looks like you know, folks aren't going to be able to shoot those little morning doves. That's losing by about 2/3. And I guess I'm not taking that one. All right, here is Joe Buckeye. Are you calling from Ohio, Joe?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Hey, I just wanted to ask you a question. Do you think this Tom Noy scandal down here in the Buckeye State, do you think this guy's really going to go to jail for all that mischief that he was up to with the mommy coin dealership and passing the funds around?
Sure. I think he'll probably there's going to be, you know, the small fry are going to take a dive. Like, you know, what was it? Wasn't the Congressman Nye? Wasn't he from Ohio too? He just resigned. And
yeah, there was
Abramoff. Yeah, Abramoff, Bush and Cheney's buddy. He's in jail, and a lot of these corporate guys are, you know, there's a few people are going to have to fall on the grenade, but ultimately they come back, like these guys that were in Bush 1 and in Reagan and got convicted of stuff. They just wound up back in the Bush gang administration.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, is that...
I'm concerned. I'm concerned because we got this election coming up. We've got people that were involved in the election now that are running that were... They say, hey, they handled this money from him, they handled this money from him, or they got money from him, or they were at his parties, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, here in Joe, I think in Ohio, unless they fiddle with the voting machines again, which is something to look out for, that the Republicans are going to really take a pasting in Ohio. All right, thank you for your call. Appreciate that. By the way, you can go, is it just the Free Press or is it the Columbus Free Press? A friend of mine edits that. Why don't I know the name of it? Find out all about Ohio politics. They do great stuff. Here's John and Warren. John, hi. You're on the air. Hey, John. Hey. All right, John. I guess we can't do it. So I guess we'll just we'll go out with the Bob Seger tune. And, I thought it was pretty moving. Good album as well. But this is called No More. It's from the Bob Seger album, the new one, Face the Promise. Hey, stay tuned for the interviews. I think you're going to like those as well.
Just heard?
Oh, yeah!
Listen up. Then head on over to the Digital Riff Music Store at WRIF.com and download your favorite riff tunes for just 99 cents.
Next song.
Stay connected. With 101 WRIF and WRIF.com. Everything that rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
More Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Pleasure to be with you, and a great pleasure to welcome back to the Peter Werby Show an old friend and a man who has written so much about rock and roll, contributed so much to our understanding of the genre, and specifically to an artist who we will mention in 1 second. His name is Dave Marsh, a native Detroiter. I'm reading, let's say hello to Dave first. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Peter.
And you think you know your friends, and then I'm reading your biography here, and it says he attended Wayne State University but failed to graduate, and I say, hey, same with me. But
I was in classes with Marilyn,
my wife.
Absolutely.
Oh, I like that. Well, she dropped out, too. We won't even talk about it.
That was 1968. If you didn't drop out, you had no education.
That's right. Hey, the brand-new book from Dave Marsh is called Bruce Springsteen on Tour, 1968 to 2005. And certainly that's not the first one that Dave Marsh has done on Bruce Springsteen. The original one, 1979, Born to Run, the Bruce Springsteen story, followed up by Glory Days, Bruce Springsteen in the 1980s for 1987. A few
dozen other books, articles, newsletters, you name it. Dave Marsh has been there with Rock and Roll. And one of the reasons that I have this great admiration for you on lots of levels, Dave, is your this encyclopedic, is it a memory? Or
It's my memory. I mean, it's like it drives people crazy around the house, you know, because I remember very, very detailed things, and it's sort of my fortune and my bane.
Now, this brand new book, and it's just beautiful. It's one of those, what do they call it, coffee table books. So it's got it's got posters. It's got photographs of Bruce Springsteen concert. It's got memorabilia. It's got stuff that you couldn't even imagine. And also the text by Dave Marsh, our guest. So tell me how you formulated this book. I can't even imagine.
They asked me if I wanted to do the book.
Uh-huh.
And you know, the stuff I've written about Bruce has been written about because I'm a fan, sort of. That was the reason him as opposed to somebody else, because a lot of it is, you know, I could have, if I thought I could, if the MC5 had lasted longer, I could have written similar books about them. But he's sort of like a classic case of somebody who's trying to maintain his integrity in this world that would give anybody conniptions. And then the other thing was that I was looking at that point to write a book about the live music experience and how it's different from the recording music experience, because I think that, in fact, while everybody's arguing about MP3s and CDs and all of the internet and all that nonsense, I think that really what's happening is music is going back to being a live experience, which I actually think is great.
Sure.
And so he is a paradigmatic, you know, he's probably, after the Elvis James Brown generation, the greatest live performer. And, you know, so for me, the timing was perfect. And then I started to realize that I could tell a lot of personal stories in it. And then, so, you know, I really let myself do some things in terms of what I had directly experienced that I didn't feel like I could do in the books that were more directly about his biographical stuff.
Now, all the material that's in here, as I said, the photographs, I mean, there's a huge number of photographers that are represented here, many of it in full-page color photographs, dramatic black and whites, as I said, posters and other stuff like this. That wasn't all, or was it? Was that all yours? Is that all stuff you've accumulated over the years?
Oh, God, no. God, no. No, no, no. Sandy and Harry Chorin, who designed the book, are people I've worked with for years, but, you know, they did an intensive, you know, they were doing intensive research of photographic material while I was racking my brain to write a book. But we worked together in such sync that it comes out looking like we all planned it together.
Okay, and how many Bruce concerts do you think you've been to?
Well, the position I take on this is that if you haven't lost count, you haven't seen very many. So I would guess it's upward of 200. Now, remember that that's 30 years... writing three books, so I had to be there in shackles. And also my wife has worked with him for 20 of those years, so some of it's been, you know, other kinds of social time. But I've seen probably 200-300 shows, and the thing about it is the consistency over that time is quite remarkable. I had to go on tour once with the Rolling Stones. I saw the Rolling Stones at Olympia in 69.
Okay.
And it was Bob Rudnick and I and a bottle of scotch. And thanks to the scotch, it's all a blur, but it's a glorious blur. And I probably, if I really racked, you know, if I thought, because I do have a pretty good memory, I could probably pick up a lot of details. I remember the weathermen storming the stage, for instance.
Ah.
But, and I remember the ending. But that was a great show. I went out on tour with the Stones in 75 for Rolling Stone magazine, and that was a horror show because you're not supposed to see that show on repeated nights. They don't change it. It's the same every night.
Well, let me get back to the Bruce Springsteen, because I'm going to ask you a question that you're going to think you don't know the answer to, but you really do. How many Bruce Springsteen concerts do you think I've seen? You know the answer.
Well, I know we saw the Seeger Sessions sitting near one another last June.
This June. Well, there you go. That's how many.
That was it?
That was it. I have seen, that was one of the greatest rock and, I don't know, greatest pieces of music, the greatest shows I've ever seen in my entire life.
Well, it's a drag for me because that band is not in the book, and that's my favorite band he's ever had.
Now, that's
my favorite is people, and my favorite is musicians.
Well, let me ask you this, Dave Marsh. 200 to 300, and you said you got tired of seeing the Rolling Stones over and over again. Do you get tired of seeing Bruce Springsteen?
Well, you know, you can get too much of anything, and once he moved to the arenas, he didn't change. I mean, in the early days when he was playing theaters, well, a lot of people did that. When people were playing theaters and people were playing the Grandy Ballroom and people were playing, you know, clubs, their sets might be radically different from one night to the next. They just have a lot of material floating around, or they'd learn a lot of other people's songs or whatever. Then when they got into the arena rock level, it couldn't change all that much because just for logistical reasons and staging reasons and lighting reasons and all of that. And you're playing to people who are much further away from you.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, could I see him five nights in a row now and wind up satisfied with every show? I don't know, because I wouldn't do that to myself, because I think, in a sense, you get a little numb to anything. But I'm going to go see him at the end of this tour. I wanted to see this man one more time, so I'm going to Dublin to see him at the end, at the middle of the month, the 16th or 17th, and of November. And I guarantee you I'll see a great show. I mean, number one, Bruce in Ireland. He's half Italian, and that is, Italy and Spain are the greatest places to see him, but Ireland's right in there. The Irish fans are crazy. And, you know, there's this other thing that happens, and this is relevant to people who are interested still in classic rock. You know, this music is much bigger overseas in Europe.
Really?
Well, I'll give you an example, okay? In the United States, Bruce will have sold by Christmas time, say, of the Seeger Sessions, in the area of 1 million copies. That's 300 million people, right?
Mm-hmm.
In Norway, he sold 150,000. The population is 4 million.
Wow.
So, you know, the difference is that because people take musicians over there more seriously, it isn't just a commodity. It's thought of as culture. It's thought of the same way that writers and stuff are thought of. And here we have this whole commodity culture going that really the classic rock stuff was very resistant to. And that's one reason why people have held on to it so long, because it isn't just Bruce. It's Lynyrd Skynyrd. It's Bob Seger. It's, you know, Bob Dylan. It's all those people. For a long time, they just kept themselves outside of the, at least the most crass parts of that marketing system.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Bruce has maintained that line harder than most people he can afford to, because he can make money the other way. But, you know, I mean, so you know, you see Bob Dylan doing ads or hear Bob Dylan songs on ads or Who songs or whatever, it's kind of a queasy feeling. For me, slightly less popular groups, my attitude about that is, well, good, that's a payday for somebody, because the music industry is sure the hell isn't going to pay them. So, you know, I mean, that's all of that. And all of that comes into it, and that's the reason you can write a lot of books about music, because really, the whole world impinges on this, and then you just kind of try to look at the vectors and see what parts of it seem important at any given moment.
Sure. Bruce Springsteen on Tours, the book, 1968-2005, my guest on the Peter Werby Show, Dave Marsh. Extraordinary book, filled with memories, filled with posters, filled with photographs. And the album, I hope everybody knows what we're talking about. If it's already sold 1 million, you probably do. It's Bruce Springsteen, We Shall Overcome, the Seeger Sessions, named after Pete Seeger, not Bob. No relation, but sort of an affinity there. In fact, here in our studio.
Oh, German-American.
Yeah. Here in our studio, we actually have a photograph of the two of them with you know, their arms around one another after a concert. And this was an extraordinary live experience that Dave Marsh and myself and thousands of others saw out at, what is it called now?
Pine Knob.
With 16 musicians doing essentially what is folk music, but it's way beyond that. It is an extraordinary experience. And let me see, was it?
What it is it's folk songs. But the arrangements are anything from rockabilly to New Orleans jazz to almost modern rock to folk music. So it's an American music experience. It really is a kind of panoramic view of the whole thing.
And it started as a CD. It is now also a DVD with more.
It actually started as these guys coming out and playing. He lives on this horse farm down in Central Jersey, and these were the guys that used to come and play the party, the birthday
really?
Party for him or his kids or whatever, and various configurations of these guys. And Bruce and his wife Patty and certain other friends of theirs who aren't in this band were here, you know. I mean, it's funny because on the wall of my office is a picture of me with a group of mariachis from one of those parties. Because, you know, because I'm like a Mexican music fiend. But, you know, so it really, part of the idea is, and I think part of what grab you, because you come from your actual music background, as I always understood it, was from the folk revival period when folk music was part of mainstream culture and musical culture in the United States, and it was a participatory thing, right?
Yeah, sure. It was all, that's kind of where, you know, I came into things. And Dave Marsh, you wrote the liner notes, and I shouldn't say this out of the air, but I had a copy of the original CD. Hey, well, let me just say parenthetically.
It's not going to bother me.
Okay, but it could bother somebody listening.
I didn't do it. I used to say to all these record executives, I don't hemorrhage when I walk by a Xerox machine.
There you go. Well, I didn't copy it. But any event, I wanted the liner notes, and I knew Dave Marsh had written them. And then I look, and I go, whoa, they're not here. But as you told me, they're at BruceSpringsteen.net.
They are.
And I was reading
longer versions that are in the record.
Yeah, and being still kind of a 20th century guy, it was hard for me to read them online. Can you print them off?
What you should have done was send me an email, and I would have emailed them back to you.
I'll still do it.
But you know what the liner notes are? My liner notes are a little misleading about the Seeger Session liner notes, because what I actually did was Bruce wanted people to know the history of wanted people to have the histories of the songs available to them. And what I really did was, without too much evaluative language, I lay out, this is where this song came from, this is who else recorded it, this is maybe some of the social context. There was one exception where I really let myself go pretty far, which was Jesse James, because Jesse James was a scoundrel, not a hero.
Yeah.
Not because he was a bank robber. I could kind of relate to a bank robber. That's an outlaw.
Right.
But because he was, you know, he was a racist. He was like a Ku Klux Klan kind of guy. Quantrill's Raiders and all that, and, you know.
These Southern...
He was a terrorist.
Confederate...
What he actually was he was a terrorist.
Yeah. But you know what? What I think it becomes a lot clearer when you read your liner notes is that Pete Seeger, who Bruce Springsteen admired so much that he dedicated a whole album of his songs to, was associated with the left wing. that folk music got a reputation in the 30s and 40s and the 50s as being communist and left wing, and Seeger was certainly.
But earned that reputation. I mean, that reputation was based on the fact that there was a mass movement of left wing ideas that was going on, and you know, of trade unions and all kinds of people associating on the basis of being working class, on the basis of being poor, on the basis of needing to cooperate, and. That was regarded during this folk revival period that we were just talking about as part of the ethic.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, the interesting thing is that the whole idea of folk music only started about another 100 years before, and it was started in Europe by extreme nationalists in Germany and England.
Really?
We know what that led to.
Sure.
You know, that leads in Germany, that leads, you know, the idea of the Volk, you know, the people, that leads directly to Nazism. Here it leads to something else, which is an idea. I think one of the reasons why folk music and rock and roll synced up is because they each had an idea about freedom. It was a slightly different idea, but it was out of the same culture, so it had an ability to fuse, and it did that.
That's my version of the story.
Well, I think so. I think you're right. Dave Marsh is my guest. The book is Springsteen on Tour, 1968 to 2005, and it's published by Bloomsbury. Now, just as we're edging into politics, Bruce Springsteen, always known with a man with a big heart, and I think people probably would identify much of what he is saying in general as having a liberal spirit. But he emerged during the 2004 election as pretty much a campaigner for John Kerry. In fact, in your book,
they were out on the plane with him at the end of the campaign.
Yeah, and there's photographs of him and Kerry together. Have you ever talked to him about his evaluation of that experience? Was he happy with it? Because you know there are obviously Republican fans of Bruce Springsteen who weren't happy
about it. We talked about it a little bit in an interview I did with him. But we haven't talked about it a lot, probably because I dislike John Kerry so much without being a Republican, far from it.
Sure.
I didn't want to get into it too much because it's like when your friends make a commitment like that, it's interesting. I mean, what was important to me, and there were a lot of friends of mine on that Vote for Change tour. I mean, Eddie Vedder's from Pearl Jam is a friend. All the guys in Pearl Jam are old friends. All the guys in the E Street Band, Jackson Browne was there, and just different people that I have a very long personal history with. My wife was out there. And, you know, my feeling about it was, you know, if you could slip a credit card between the ideology of Kerry and the ideology of Bush, you'd be doing very well. To me, the difference between maybe Kerry wasn't going to end the war in Iraq. He didn't want to. So it was like, and I talk about this in the book, it's this weird experience of like, you know, me going to John Kerry's website, trying to be very informed as a journalist and all that, knowing what Kerry is saying, and then hearing Bruce come out and talk about all the things that Kerry could have and should have been talking about, and then Kerry coming out and basically going to a press conference or something and denying that any of that had anything to do with him. And then Bruce coming out the next night doing the same thing. And it was like this weird marriage where they weren't listening to each other, and that was why they could stay together.
Well, it's certainly true that the Democratic base is so far to the left of the Democratic candidates, and it's true in this election as well. In today's New York Times, on the front page, there's an article about how conservative many of the Democratic Party candidates are. But I guess the question was motivated by was this, in your estimation, unique, this direct insertion into the political process for Bruce?
I don't think any, you know, it happened at the other end of a campaign. In 1976, Jimmy Carter's initial fundraising was done, you may remember this, by concerts that were put together by a guy named Phil Walden who ran Capricorn Records and who controlled most of Southern Rock, so that Jimmy Carter's seed money came from the Allman Brothers, basically.
Huh.
And so that's the historical parallel. But this is different because Bruce is different, because he symbolizes something in a way that Greg Allman and Dwayne Allman didn't, for better or for worse. Well, Dwayne was dead by then, but you know, the Allman Brothers didn't mean, you know, this is more like if Bob Dylan had gone out and campaigned for Eugene McCarthy or something. My thing is, I'm very interested in politics. I'm not terribly interested in elections. I don't think they solve very many problems. So, you know, I think a lot of fairy tales get told, and some of them are helpful, and some of them are harmful, you know. But, you know, I would, you know, if I, look, here's the thing. Bruce is my friend, and he made a commitment, and he did the best he could inside that commitment. Certainly, if he had asked me what he should do, I would have said, well, you should continue doing what you're doing, which is about empowering people every day, not once every 4 years, to go and cast a ballot, but to empowering people every day to try to work together to change their social and economic conditions. To me, that's the spirit of rock and roll. That's the spirit of folk music, and that's effective politics.
And that's what he's done in terms of generosity and sharing oftentimes the proceeds from concerts to help groups that are trying to help people.
Every concert since 1984, he has worked with some group like that here overseas. I mean, it's interesting, you know, like there are countries, Japan being one, where there isn't a lot of private social work. or charity. So, you know, they can have a hard time finding. There's nothing like a food bank in Japan. It doesn't exist.
Huh.
So what they ended up doing was giving some money, the first time at least, giving some money to the widows of men who had been killed in traffic accidents because apparently they have a very, very difficult time. They can't remarry, and there's just all these taboos that gets into.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but yeah, every concert, there's that commitment, and that's, I guess that's part of what he's trying to say to people. And so, you know, that's what, you know, and that's just the reason, another reason why I've stuck with rock and roll writing and stuck with rock and roll and related music, rhythm and blues and hip hop and jazz and all kinds of things like that, is that those musics are about empowerment. For the most part, they're not performed by an elite for an elite. They're performed by people for people. And that message needs to be sent out there. And that's my, as a writer, activist, whatever, that's my particular area of concern. I think it's also Bruce's particular area of concern, but like a lot of people from working class backgrounds in America, he sees that particular elite that calls itself the Democratic Party as on their side. I think he's wrong.
Well, I certainly share that. I'm trying to think where I saw this, but in 2004, when there were demonstrations against the Republican National Convention in New York City, there was about 20 or 30,000 people, and I think it was the New York Times did a count, and they saw 14 pro-Kerry signs. You know what I'm saying? In other words, this was an anti-Bush demonstration, and it was an anti-Bush election.
I think that's right, and I think that what I'm saying tends to ignore, not to my credit, is that how scared people were and how right they were to be scared of Kerry. Hey, I voted for John Kerry. You know, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is, if you're going to take your time and your energy, a better place to take and put it is with your friends and neighbors, because you can trust them.
Absolutely. Hey, Dave Marsh, we got about 60 seconds left, and as usual, we've missed hours and hours of talking over the years, and we can't make it up in 60 seconds. This wonderful book, Bruce Springsteen on Tour, 1968-2005. Is there more? Is he as energized as he ever was? Is there going to be more there?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, the guy's 57 years old. He's not going to stop. You know, you stop at 57 when you're 57 if you have a disease. He's got rock and rollitis. That makes you do more.
Well, what I meant more was it doesn't seem. I was in, you know, like about where you were at the June concert at Pine Knob, this man looked like he was loving every minute of it. He's not jaded. He's not tired.
Got my 83-year-old mother to dance.
Yeah, and he didn't. He dedicated a song to her.
He did. He did. We Shall Overcome tour.
Oh, yes, that was wonderful.
You know, it was wonderful.
It was indeed. And as always, it's wonderful talking with you, Dave Marsh.
Well, it's great to talk to you, Peter, and people don't know this, but you played such an important role for me in my early writing life, and we've stayed friends for all this time. I mean, it's going on. It's approaching 40 years.
Right.
And, you know, I can't tell you how important that friendship and the confidence you displayed to me when I was a kid was. And I also can't tell you how important it is to be from the Motor City and to never forget that, and the lessons you learn there about solidarity and loyalty and what friendship really is, and how no matter where it comes from, you can be artistic, you can be creative, and you can be powerful.
All right, before I tear up, I'm going to say goodbye. Dave Marsh, thank you so much. The book again, Bruce Springsteen on Tour, 1968-2005. It covers this incredible history of one of America's most important performers. A beautiful book. Go get it.
Thank you.
Dave Marsh, thank you.
This is WRIM.com.
Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you. If you saw the news recently, George Bush has signed a bill that's authorizing a 700-mile border fence. That's along the southern border. And there you go. You can kind of see me knocking the dust off my hand because that takes care of those darn immigrants, doesn't it? Well, of course it doesn't. And I thought I knew quite a bit about this whole question of immigration and the impact it has on our country, its culture, its economy, and I had some pretty simple answers, one of them which I think probably will suffice, but there is so much to this, and looking at a book that came my way, I realized in a lot of ways how little I knew and how important it is if we're going to make major decisions and make major pronouncements like I'm given to. We better know what we're talking about, and I guess, dear listener, I would say the same for you. Joining me is Michelle Wooker, and Michelle Wooker is the author of Lockout, Why America Keeps Getting Immigration Wrong When Our Prosperity Depends on Getting It Right. And Michelle Wooker is a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute at the New School in New York City. She lectures frequently about immigration, international economics, and business, has written for and been interviewed by many of the world's leading media, which is why I welcome her now to the Peter Werby Show. Michelle Wooker, welcome to the broadcast.
Thanks for having me.
There is so much involved here, everything from electoral politics to the actual and real impact all of this has on our lives. But really, the United States has never gotten it right on immigration back when we were saying no Irish need apply for jobs when they started coming over here, right?
It's a very, very familiar story. We're doing very much what we did in the past, the time we said, oh, there's a thousand reasons why the people who are coming today, you know, the famous these people, in quotation marks, why they would never become Americans and settle in, why they're so different from the people who came before. Of course, we were wrong 100 years ago and 100 years before that, and we're wrong today.
Now, how tell us about some of the groups. I mentioned the Irish, and, of course, Irish are so much a part of Americana that it's a little hard, I think, for people to realize that they were a despised immigrant group.
You look at the newspaper articles and the cartoons in particular for the time, and the people are just displayed incredibly grotesquely. And a lot of other people who today you hear could become Americans because they were white in the first place, 100 years ago were not viewed as being white. Jews, Slavs, Irish, Italians, they actually had studies commissioned by Congress where they would go and measure people's skulls intended to prove that they were racially inferior. And so I think it goes to show just how much race is something that's in our head. America certainly has a long way to go on race, but I think if you look at how far we've come and how we've forgotten that some people who we say are just like us today in the past were seen as so different, I think it's a little encouraging, actually, about the changes that we can make in our attitudes towards people who come here today.
Well, is that why we've gotten it wrong in that regard? Is that although we pride ourselves on giving you, all of a sudden I can't remember what's at the base of the Statue of Liberty, but most people remember, give me your tired, your hungry masses, where the people at the time, whether it was the 1890s or the whatever period in the United States, we actually didn't want the tired and hungry masses. So yeah, is that what we've gotten wrong, or is it a greater breadth to it than that?
Well, I think it's much bigger. I think we focus a lot on whatever misconceptions we may have about whatever characteristics of immigrants who happen to be coming today. And we forget that the things that we do in America have a huge impact on how well immigrants are going to be able to integrate into American society, on how successful they're going to be socially and economically, and whether they're going to be able to reach out towards this American dream that we all still want to believe in.
Well, how did take two classic examples, or two examples of classic immigrant groups, Jews and Italians,
who were thought of as threats, everything from threats to our culture to threats to public safety. I don't think too many people realize that the immigrant Jews of the 1890s were thought to be almost genetically criminal by the police chief of New York City. And as very frequently happens, poor people and poor immigrants often can meet some of the stereotypes. I mean, in fact, if stereotypes don't have some basis in reality, they're unrecognizable. But the fears turned out to be unjustified about those two particular groups. But so how did they transform from non-white, unwelcome immigrants to pillars of our communities?
Well, that's a very good question, because what we think about how they transformed is not actually how it happened. There's this sort of myth that people who came here in the past all of a sudden stripped away everything from the old country. They became Americans. They cut their ties to the old country. Now, for a lot of the Jews who came here 100 years ago, they didn't have much choice because there wasn't anybody left in the old country after the pogroms. But for a lot of other groups, and for some of the Jews who did still have family back in the countries of their birth, they had hometown associations with very, very close ties. Italians, Irish, other groups that were derided as being hyphenated, actually transformed this hyphenated identity. They didn't leave behind everything about their home country. They simply transformed it into making it part of America. I mean, pizza, all the ethnic food we hear about is a classic example of that transformation. But all sorts of other things culturally were very much true as well. And immigrants also played a huge role in helping other immigrants from the same country to transform, to make that transition into being American. They took on a lot of the responsibility for teaching English, for finding housing, finding jobs, life insurance, burial societies, and even in urging immigrants to go ahead and become citizens. But what happened during the time of the First World War is there was a real backlash against any sign that you were foreign. And a big part of that was because so many people who were still German citizens in the United States technically could have been drafted into the enemy armies. But there was this huge push across the country to intimidate immigrants out of speaking other languages, to keep them from showing any sort of pride or even nostalgia for their homeland. And so that resulted in the destruction of a lot of these ethnic groups, these fraternal benefit societies. And I think it destroyed this very, very important unit of community. When we think about how national loyalty or other communities are formed, it really starts on the local level with whatever it is that you have in common with the people that you know. Once you've made that little social network, you can expand to other networks. So today, when we try to insist that immigrants need to let go the old country, to give up their old culture, that's not even something that immigrants did in the past. That really their ties to people from their home countries were what promoted helping people to become Americans instead of the other way around. So it would be a huge mistake to see the ties that immigrants have with their home countries or with people from their same country as being bad for America.
Michelle Wooker is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. The book is Lockout, Why America Keeps Getting Immigration Wrong When Our Prosperity Depends on Getting It Right. It's the publisher is Public Affairs. And you can go to Wooker.com, W-U-C-K-E-R.com. And I don't want to lose sight of the economic impact. And we're pretty much just focused on the cultural impact. And there is another little aspect that I know you know of, that in the first part of this century, is a lot of the radicals of the time were of ethnic origins from Eastern Europe, including Eastern European Jews and Southern Europeans like Italians and Greeks. So this was a sort of like another strike against it. But we don't have that today. And it in terms of still sticking with the cultural impact, it depends on where you are. I mean, there's a number of small towns around that are, in fact, now in Georgia, North Carolina, places like that, that suddenly feel overwhelmed by Hispanic immigrants, where, although there's an old Hispanic community in Detroit, I don't think anyone here feels a cultural wave. In other words, we're very happy to have our Hispanic community and its location, but other people all of a sudden go, whoa, wait a minute, all of a sudden all the stores have Spanish signs and people are speaking Spanish on the street, and it's upsetting to them.
And absolutely, any sort of huge demographic change like that is going to be traumatic. And I think it's important to recognize that there are changes that are going to be difficult for everyone. You can't just gloss it over. And that again goes back to the idea of what are we doing, particularly with helping people to learn English and to try to understand American civic values or what it really means to be American. We're so good at saying what we're not. These colors don't run. If you're not with us, you're against us. We can say that, but we're not very good as Americans at communicating to immigrants what it is that's so great about America, what we're proud of, and what we want them to embrace as well. And as far as English, there are a lot of misconceptions about how much immigrants want to learn English or not. If you look at the polls, the surveys of immigrants, and the vast, vast, vast majority absolutely want to learn English, want their children to learn English. The problem is that since there's so much immigration right now, there are so many people who've only been here, a year, 2 years, 5 years. And because Americans have put so little emphasis on learning foreign languages, a lot of us forget just how long it takes to become really comfortable in another language. And often that doesn't happen until the second generation. At the same time, we're not looking hard enough at how Americans can help to make sure that immigrants learn English. Across the country, there are huge waiting lists for English classes, which drives home the reality that immigrants do want to learn English, but not as many of them as want to learn English have the opportunity to do so. So I think we really need to look at how we as a country, not just government, but also businesses, and I know a lot of churches have been interested in offering English language classes. But the question is, what can we do to make this process easier?
Well, Michelle Wooker, let's go to the economic end of it. And the subtitle of your book, Lockout, is Why America Keeps Getting Immigration Wrong and When Our Prosperity Depends on Getting It Right, which of course, that's why you have a whole book. It's not supposed to be all there in the subtitle. But I think at least one popular conception, or maybe a misconception, is that we're being inundated with people that are taking away American jobs, whether and we keep talking about immigration. And I believe, please correct me if I'm wrong, that the immigration we were talking about in the past, the vast majority of it was legal immigration. And now that a good part of the problem, and why Bush signed this bill for the 700-mile fence, which actually there's not even any money in the bill to build a fence, is that we're being subjected, we the American people, to illegal immigration. So talk to us a little, if you would, about how that's different than in the past and what effect this is having.
Well, part of the problem is that it was very hard to come illegally before the 1920s, unless you were, for example, Chinese after the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act. And then in the beginning of the 20th century, there were a number of other laws that were put in place to prevent other Asian immigration. But the illegal immigrant didn't even exist, really, until the 1920s. So if someone bragging that their ancestors came 100 years ago and they came legally. Well, it's not that much to brag about because it was hard not to come legally. The other thing is that we changed a lot of laws towards Latin American immigrants in the 1960s. And so people who previously had been crossing the border and people didn't really count that much, all of a sudden became included in sort of national origins quotas and things like that, whereby, you know, no particular country could get more than a certain percent of the visa. So all of a sudden, people who'd been coming all of a sudden were legal, in when they had been legal in the past. So it's a little unfair to blame it on the immigrants when it's actually our system that has changed. And at the same time, we've made it very hard for hardworking, law-abiding immigrants to come under the laws because we don't provide enough visas to sort of match our workforce needs with the number of people who come. So it's another example of where our own policies have added to the problems.
Mm-hmm. Now, I got to believe there's at least one person listening that's going, yeah. Here's another liberal soft on illegal immigrants, and we got these guys that are taking our jobs and ruining our economy, and she's saying that we ought to have more classes for English for them. What, I don't know, you might just walk away. I was going to say, how do you respond? You might say goodbye. But I think you know what I mean, the general reaction to being swamped by illegal workers that'll drive down, the wages of all of us.
Well, it's actually, the people being illegal is part of the problem for wages. A lot of people argue that it's the number of immigrants who come that drive down wages. If you look at the economic studies of it, there's a huge literature on people like David Card, Giovanni Perry, who are in a big fight with George Borjas on the other side of this. But a lot and a growing number of economic studies show that the only people who immigrants lower wages for, and this is even a very small part. This is some studies say 1%, some studies 2%, none of them more than 10%. The impact is on Americans who haven't finished high school. But for all other Americans, immigration raises both national wealth and wages. So it seems to me that the solution...
Whoa, I rarely interrupt people, but people just went, wait a minute, did she say raise wages? How would that happen?
Absolutely. Well, back to old sort of classical economics, specialization of labor. There are a lot of Americans who have college degrees, who are skilled, who can go and do higher wage jobs now, higher skilled jobs, because they have people to help them out with some of the, they have a nanny, they have people to take care of their lawn, things like that. And so when you have a specialization of labor like that, it allows people to focus on whatever part of work that their skills are most attuned to.
Mm-hmm.
So what we need to do is make sure that more Americans are educated and educated well, not just not just high school, but go on to get the minimum associate's degree, get a college degree. And as that happens, paradoxically, the fewer Americans who haven't finished high school, the more we'll actually depend on immigrants to perform some of the lower-skilled, lower-wage jobs.
Well, a lot of it is perception, too, Michelle Walker. I just came back from New York City, and as you full well know, that's where we're reaching you. It seems that everyone in a service job is foreign-born, particularly Latin. And yet the figures that you give in your book, Lockout, are extraordinary. You would think that immigrants make up about 90% of low-wage workers, but I wonder if you could kind of reel off some of these figures as to what percentage immigrant foreign-born workers make up different sectors of our work society.
Sure. Sure. Well, immigrants, I should say, in the overall picture, although immigrants are highly concentrated in some particular fields, they're actually, the immigrants are either on the low end or the high end of jobs, but only 20% of all immigrants work in the stereotypical low-wage occupations, the strawberry pickers, the day laborers, the other agricultural and construction service jobs. But, for example, of research and development workers, 50% are foreign-born. So that's where we really depend on immigrants. About 25% of doctors and nurses are foreign-born. So, on the low end, a large percentage of, for example, agricultural workers, I think about 37% of all agricultural workers are immigrants. About 42% of people who do landscaping and house cleaning are immigrants. But as a percentage of all immigrants, that's actually a very, very small part. And because we're so focused on the low end, we've forgotten about the high end, and people who are working in a high-skilled job can't come here without papers. The kind of jobs they want, just it's impossible to do without papers, and they don't want to come in, under the shadows. So those people are also having a hard time getting into this country legally, and that's a very, very serious problem at a time when technology, science, engineering are the parts of the economy that are going to create the biggest economic growth and that we really depend on now.
But, and also, of course, essentially what you're saying is the higher you go up the economic ladder, the absolute the will be that they will be legal immigrants. One of the things I think we should look at is how is this being utilized within the political arena? We're coming up to an election, and suddenly immigration is being presented, and also by some TV commentators, as the single most the biggest problem facing this country. It's not Iraq, it's not how the economy is going overall. And, of course, I hope no one is making the argument that Ford workers or Delphi workers or General Motors workers or anybody like that is losing their jobs because of immigrant workers. That's because of the rich guys in the suits at the top have just made catastrophic errors. But this has become a political football, hasn't it?
Yeah, and it's very, very simple why. And in fact, going across the country, this is the question I get asked the most. Why is this such a big deal now? And there are two reasons. One, our system is broken, but it's not the guys who are screaming about the need to put fences on the borders who get what's broken. The problem is that we don't have enough visas for the people who come legally, and so that way the people who are crossing the border illegally, who are overstaying their visas, and you end up mixing the people who want to follow the law with the people who don't want to follow the law, and it becomes much harder to find the people who don't want to follow the law. We're creating a haystack to put right on top of a needle. But the other part of it, so there have been very sensible proposals, particularly some of the measures that are in the Senate right now to try to fix that situation. But those proposals have created a backlash because the oldest trick in the Politics 101 textbook is if you're doing something wrong, then you need to distract people. And immigrants, foreigners, because it's very easy to dehumanize them and demonize them, it's really easy to blame them for everything that's going wrong. So we have a country where there's, huge government corruption, the sort of disastrous policies in Iraq, this sort of corporate trickery and people getting away with it, Congress at the lowest popularity and approval rating in I don't know how long. These people are in trouble. They're not educating Americans the way they need to be. They're not providing health care. And so if they can come out and say, our schools aren't working because of the immigrants, our health care is not working because of the immigrants, then it's a really easy way to distract people. But the truth is that if every single illegal immigrant in this country were to just disappear in a puff of smoke tomorrow, that's not going to solve any of the underlying problems, that our schools still aren't educating Americans in the way that people need to be educated to compete in a global workforce, that we're not providing Americans with health care, that economic inequality is increasing, that, that people are feeling like they're falling behind. And so the ruckus over immigration doesn't even really have to do with immigrants. It's about politicians who want people to talk about something instead of what the politicians are doing really, really wrong.
Hmm. And I wonder if this is going to be successful. In many ways, it doesn't seem to resonate as much as one would suspect. But all of a sudden, I look at the clock, and we are completely out of time. And we have scratched the surface from this in this amazing book by our guest, Michelle Walker. It's called Lockout, Why America Keeps Getting Immigration Wrong When Our Prosperity Depends on Getting It Right. And think about the implications of that subtitle. Before any of us go off half-cocked, we ought to know all the answers. Many of them are contained within this book. It's published by Public Affairs. You can go to Michelle's website. It's Wucker.com, W-C-K-E-R.com. And I'll have a link at my site, PeterWerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E. Michelle Walker, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
My pleasure.
And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Hard Rock Cafe, featuring Saliva, along with Detroit's own Radio Crap. Friday, November 17th.
Keep listening for more details
from 101 The Riff.